Midwest EPA Chief Mary Gage, neo-futurist and screeching weasel guitarist John Jughead Pearson, and another installment of Character Flaws. And now, here's your host, a man who won 6 coin tosses to host this show, Justin Kaufman.
I'll take tails again. I love that story. You know what? She won it. She won the whole caucus because she flipped a coin. Come on. She can be so gullible sometimes here in this country. Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Download. I'm Justin Kaufman here on WGN Radio with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a spectacular show lined up for you. Can't wait to get at it. It's a nice hump day jam, as we say, you know? I'm the Download's camel. It's hump day. We'll get the latest on the war that is mobilizing around Chicago school children. The Chicago Public Schools and Chicago Teachers Union are ratcheting up the rhetoric while Governor Rauner wants in on the fight too. He's like a tag team wrestler. Tag me in, reach in. I want to get in so bad. Mike Fouché will join us to talk about today's actions against Bank of America and to get the real story on whether or not we are heading to DEFCON 3 and the dreaded S word, strike. Can you hear that? Strike. I don't want to say it. Strike. My guest tonight at the big table, this is a real treat. Mary Gade was the Midwest director for the EPA back under President Bush. She's been quite critical of how the government has handled the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. We're going to talk to her about preparedness and politics and what the government has to do when it comes to environmental disasters. There's this hearing today that started in Flint, Michigan, just about what happened there. And it really looks like this is more of a political problem than an environmental one, meaning they knew what was happening and they chose to ignore it. So we'll talk with Mary Gade about her own story about politics, interfering with her and her work back in 2008. That's coming up at 8 o'clock. And later tonight, a couple of Renaissance men join me, former Chicago Tribune reporter turned filmmaker Kevin Pang, going to talk about the digital release of his film For Grace, which follows Chicago chef Curtis Duffy from a tumultuous childhood to being one of the best chefs in the world. And John Jughead Pearson's back, the guitarist from Screeching Weasel and the ensemble member for the Neo Futurists, is leaving town once again to practice his wizardry in Japan. I'm not kidding. He's a Japanese wizard. What does that mean? John will explain. He'll explain here at 9 o'clock hour. And it's Wednesday night, so it's time for Character Flaws, our weekly hour that brings you sketch comedy characters, improvisation, the best that this great city has to offer. Tonight, we'll also go into the archives to tribute Bob and Ray on this day. Bob Elliott passed away. He was 92 years old. He died. We'll play some of their stuff. Amazing radio production, comedy radio from some of the greats tonight on The Download. All that plus news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. And production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. And this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who live here. All right, let's get this underway. Let's get to the carryout, of course. This is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Hey, when you can't beat the city, beat its bank. Chicago Teachers Union withdrew almost $1 million today from Bank of America, a bank that has profited off of interest swaps with the city. Essentially, they're making a huge amount of money off of bad city deals, and the city won't do anything about it. What? Come on, seriously? There's not a rich person in the world that's getting screwed over by bad bank deals, right? I mean, I could get out of a bad bank deal, and the city of Chicago can't? I know, I'm with CTU on this one. Donald Trump is livid with Senator Ted Cruz, saying he stole the election in Iowa with dirty political tricks. You know what? I think Trump is right on. Cruz sent around vague, shady flyers to voters, essentially telling them to not vote. And then on the actual caucus, circulated a rumor that Ben Carson was dropping out so that Carson's supporters would go for him. Now, Trump is a whiny baby and a huge loser. But isn't this why he's in the race? To point out how dishonest the process is? And you wonder why people are voting Trump. I mean, it makes sense. But then all you got to do is look down the Chicago River and see that monstrous sign on the building that says, Trump! And then you start to get the feeling that this is not real, that maybe this is like a comic book, and that Donald Trump is like Lex Luthor. Remember, Luthor ran for president, and his vice president was the Joker. So, wait, does that make Bernie Sanders Batman? Uh-oh. A lot of climbing. Also, Jeb Bush made a speech today in New Hampshire and nobody clapped. Come on, voters. Jeb's people, too. On the other side, the rhetoric of a recount has pumped the brakes. Sanders was talking about re-caucusing because the vote was so close. When reached for comment, Senator Sanders said, "Hello? Hello, who's this? Is this the gas company I paid you last month? Hello? Hello? What button do I push here? Hello?" Rick Santorum is suspending his campaign for president. What can you say? It's been bad. Suspension is the only recourse. I mean, next, expulsion. This leaves way too many candidates left, but good start. The Florida governor filed for the state of emergency in four counties today because of the Zika virus. Nine people have been affected. This is really so funds, both federal and local, can be released to fight this. Wait, let me back up here. Nine people. Nine. Come on, he can get state of emergency for nine people with an ancient virus, yet we can't get a state of emergency for counties affected by gun violence? I mean, we got like 50 people dead, 200 shot a month. Somebody get Rauner on the line now. Oh, he's not available. He's at Bank of America with Rahm. Oh, cool. Last night was the premiere of The People vs. O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story, and it was the most watched premiere in FX history, which probably isn't saying much, but it was must-watch TV just to see how they worked the Kardashians into the plot. It's safe to say that this series is not a documentary. Courtney, Kim, Chloe, stop running around the funeral that we were at. It's so dumb. Next, the 10-year-old Kanye is going to be walking by saying, "Man, who's that girl? When I grow up, I'm going to be a rapper." And then Cuba Gooding's going to cry some more. Lots of Cuba Gooding Jr. crying. See that? Lots. Well, somewhat recommended. In weather, what happened to the snow? Huh? I thought there was going to be a big snowstorm. I blame Rahm. In sports, Blackhawks got back to winning last night and hope to continue that streak tomorrow in Phoenix. Back home, Mickey Mouse and Goofy did a great pirouette on Disney and Ice. It's really nice. The Bulls continue their rumble and stumble tour out west against Sacto. No word on whether or not everyone's getting traded. If Mirotić gets dealt, the other team would have to take his colostomy bag. He's still out after stomach surgery. No word on when and if he'll return. But no worries, Mike Dunleavy's back. He may join the team on Friday. Last night, DePaul basketball must have taken a five-hour energy. They upset 11th-ranked Providence at the Allstate Arena. Now, I thought it was a bit much that the fans stormed the court and then everybody ran down the expressway and bum-rushed that Outback Steakhouse. But hey, you know, that's what you do when you play college basketball in Rosemont. In football, it was National Signing Day, and everyone's going to Michigan. Tomorrow, 30 for 30. You excited? The 85 Bears finally get some much-needed attention with a documentary. I really hope Brian Bashnagel's shoes are prominently featured, right? Remember he had the high tops? I hope there's a lot of Bashnagel. And don't look now, but we're only 2 weeks away from pitchers and catchers reporting in Arizona. Come on. And finally tonight, a Business Insider story says that Taco Bell is overtaking Chipotle when it comes to millennials. They cite one key advantage: better toilet paper. Oh, come on. Gross. Come on. Come on. Well, that's the carryout for February 3rd, 2016. Hey, you don't have to worry about toilet paper with us. We go two-ply. We're fancy.
Coming up, Mike Fouché is going to be here from All the Track. We're going to talk about all the big news today surrounding Chicago Public Schools. They got the bond. Huge interest rate. We'll talk about that. Also, we'll talk about CTU and Bank of America and the quote-unquote act of war. It's a download here on WGN. Stay with us. This is a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest every Wednesday, Mike Fouché. He's the man behind AlderTrack.com, a subscription newsletter for all covering all things Chicago politics. And man, oh man, CPS versus CTU. This is becoming a heavyweight fight.
And we are all the gloves getting. I mean, basically, we're taking the damage. Good times.
Not good. All right. So today, the big story today, I mean, it started with sort of political theater I guess financial theater, and the idea that the Chicago Teachers Union withdrew their money from Bank of America because Bank of America is one of the big banks that the city of Chicago has done interest swaps with,
toxic swaps.
And they're making a ton of money off the off the city and the CPS.
Right, and CTU, the teachers union, basically says, well, the schools are still paying hundreds of millions of dollars or tens of millions of dollars of payments for these toxic swaps.
Which date back to the Blagojevich administration.
Wrong guy, but same era. You know, they say, well, you're paying the banks, but you're not taking care of our kids in the school and the teachers in the schools. So they went to the bank teller at Bank of America and they said, we'd like our $1 million, please. And the teller said, okay.
Here you go.
And that was it. Literally, the teller said, okay. Yeah.
I think it's more symbolic, though, that they want to take their money out of big banks or banks that they feel have done wrong to the kids.
This is the thing that's kind of interesting. You know, $1 million. Ooh, yeah. Wow. $1 million. That's a lot of money. But when you get down to it, the amount of money that we're talking about that's going on in the toxic swaps is hundreds of millions. And so a $1 million check is really, you know, small.
Well, speaking of, you know, finance, I mean, finally, this evening, it was announced that the Chicago Public Schools was able to get the bond at a very, very high rate.
Right.
Higher than what it was last week.
8.5 and borrowing less money.
Borrowing less money.
So they originally were going to go to market last week. They were going to try and take $875 million at 7.75, and that didn't work. You know, whether it was called that they pulled the deal or the deal failed,
right.
And so they decided they were going to try again this week. And you know, we've heard that there was a lot of negotiating, trying to get investors. Well, you know, how much do you guys want to pay for this? And so finally, investors came together. And they were able to sell $725 million, so $150 million less, and at a higher rate of 8.5. Now, in order to give you a sense of what 8.5 means, that is about 6.5% higher than the average borrowing that's done by a municipal bond deal that's investment grade. So that's really, really high.
This is unprecedented. I mean, that's, we really need to stress that, you know, beyond, I was reading somewhere the stat that it was Puerto Rico's the only other, the biggest deal with this high of percentage rate.
Right.
But Puerto Rico's, I mean, this is shambles. This is unprecedented for a municipality to borrow at this level.
And let's, you know, everyone's like, oh, Puerto Rico, they're in the Caribbean. Of course, they're supposed to be bad. But the reason why Puerto Rico's in such poor shape is that people are actually leaving Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is getting smaller. And so they have less and less people in order to pay taxes, in order to pay these bonds. Chicago doesn't really have that problem. We have very robust tax base. The issue that the Chicago Public Schools has is that the tax base is frozen, and the property taxes can't get bigger unless the state and Springfield says, okay, fine, you can raise taxes above the cap.
All right, let me ask you this, because this was something, I mean, let's get to the politics part, and then I want to ask about what this means for negotiations for a teacher's contract. But politics-wise, Rahm Emanuel, the mayor, went to New York City in this sort of...
On Monday.
Yeah, this idea, and you tell me, but with the idea that he was going to be able to talk to some of his financial buddies into making this happen.
Well, first off, it's not unusual for a big city mayor to go visit the bond houses, the investors, in order to sweet talk them and tell their story. Every major city mayor does that. Okay, so it's not like he was going.
It wasn't like an emergency type thing.
Well,
I mean, it was.
The timing certainly was interesting. And his folks said, well, this was a long planned trip. Sure, he planned to go at some point. Did he plan to go on Monday? Who knows? But so he went and made a tour in order to convince everybody that they should buy Chicago bonds for the public schools and everything's going to be okay. And so at about the same time, Governor Bruce Rauner steps up to the microphone and says, oh, hey, guys, I want to remind everybody that I have this great Chicago public school bankruptcy plan and to take over the schools.
And I'm even preparing for it, even though it was kind of dead in the water when he brought it up.
Right.
And it was he came back again and he said, I just want to let everyone know I'm preparing.
Right. Right. And the fact is that that's really a pile, because you can't prepare because it has to be approved by the state legislature.
So what is Governor Rauner I'll ask, and this was brought up by you today in Aldertrack, and Rich Miller downstate,
and Dan Mielopoulos wrote about it today.
So let me ask the question. I mean, Governor Rauner is a very shrewd and smart businessman. That's what we brought him to politics to do. He knows that by going in and talking about the B word, bankruptcy, he's going to scare off bond investors.
Right.
Did he do that on purpose to mess with the CPS bond?
All right. Well, I am not a psychic, and I cannot read his mind. But if I was somebody that was trying to game out a specific theory, it certainly would be to Bruce Rauner's it would be to his favor to force the Chicago Public Schools and the mayor of Chicago to the table at Springfield, because he has this thing, and I talk about it every week, called the turnaround agenda, where he wants to cap property taxes, he wants to change tort laws, and he also wants to eliminate collective bargaining for government employees. And so Democrats in Springfield, which are dominated by Chicagoans, don't want to pass that, and he hasn't been able to get it through the legislature. Now he's got something that Chicago really cares about, the schools. And if he's able to drive the schools into bankruptcy and drive everybody to the table to negotiate with him, then he's able to say, oh, I've got this thing called the turnaround agenda. I think I need you guys to support this before I'm going to be able to...
Before we sign on the dotted line, let me grab
exactly.
This. So let me ask you, because you know this all is happening at the same time as negotiations with the Chicago Teachers Union over a contract. We saw, I think it was Friday, hey, there's a serious offer on the table. It's going to the top brass at CTU. Right. It's a serious offer. I mean, by Sunday, the news was like, this is great. There's there's going to be a signed contract. Monday comes, bam. No contract.
Done.
What happened?
So there's so what's really crazy is that it's not crazy. It's just the way it is that the Chicago Teachers Union actually has political parties inside of it. And there's a political party inside of Chicago Teachers Union called CORE. And I can't remember what it stands for, but it's a much more leftist, much more strident organization. And the CORE membership, people that were in CORE, really ended up being against the contract. And the big things that they were really against was the teachers union has been asking the mayor to commit TIF dollars, tax increment finance dollars, and there's some chunk of change. It's a big black box. Nobody knows how much it is, but it could be as much as $700 million to commit them to the schools in order to take care of the school financing problems now, today.
As opposed to renegotiating and taking away essentially salary from teachers.
And actually, if the mayor decided to, he could declare a big chunk of change, $700 million, as surplus tomorrow. And because of the way that the formula is, half of that would end up going to Chicago Public Schools. So $350 million could go to public schools tomorrow and could solve a lot of their finance
gaps. This is why when you hear Karen Lewis or Jesse Sharkey in the news talking about the doomsday. That's what they mean, is the fact that the city likes to come out and say, we have no money, we're strapped. And they say, we have to cut these salaries, we have to get rid of this. But there really is an option for a big chunk of change if they wanted to do that.
There is a TIF account, and the TIF account has it has about $1.7 billion in it. But exactly how it's accounted for, nobody really knows. The mayor's office has kept it dark. So the teachers union, members of the teachers union, said, well, you guys aren't really playing ball with us, because we really want you to do this with the TIF money, and you should just commit it to the schools and solve all of our problems today, and then it wouldn't be a problem. But see, here's the thing.
Until next year. But go ahead.
Exactly. So Rahm Emanuel really doesn't want to have to do that, because if he does that, it's a very slippery slope to all TIF money ultimately going to schools.
Well, it'll just become
the TIF,
which has been very controversial. But it has gone to playgrounds, to parks, to new building construction.
Yes.
They want it. They use that almost as a capital fund.
So the TIF money in Chicago is the mayoral equivalent of the CIA black fund. Nobody, you know, there's some amount of money in it. Nobody exactly knows what's being done with it, how much there is, and the mayor can use it in order to solve whatever political problems he has. If he starts committing that TIF money to schools, bye-bye black fund.
Yeah.
And so that's a problem for him. So the teachers saw that, and they said, you know, we don't want to be part of this.
Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to ask about what's next, because we saw what the teachers union said was an act of war and what they called retaliation, that the CPS...
More importantly, they said you can't be trusted.
Yeah. They came back and said CPS, Forrest Claypool, says we're going to have to cut $100 million more.
Right.
Which was not on the table, and they were going to do that coming up here in February. We've been talking about that for months now. Let's Let's take a break. We come back, find out where we're at. Is that real? Is that going to happen? Does the bond today, does that help? A lot of unanswered questions. Mike Fouché from AlderTrack.com in studio with me tonight. We'll be right back.
That's some smooth stuff there, Justin.
That's why I played it out a little bit. You know, Zim, he does the beats. Damn. The first time I heard it, I'm like, oh, I'm keeping this one.
I mean, this is practically like some late night lover music. Yeah.
Call in right now. We'll give you some advice, some relationship advice.
Straight from me.
Straight from Mike Fouché from AlderTrack.com. A subscription newsletter covering all things Chicago politics. Let's talk, I mean, the unanswered questions. Was, the $100 million, is that covered by today's bond news, or is that this $100 million that they need to cut?
Yeah, so the bonds were $150 million less is what they got from the bonds, right. And Claypool is going to actually be cutting more than $100 million. There's $100 million of cuts that he's going to be making, and then there's also pension reductions that should lead to another pension. They're no longer doing the pension pickup for the teachers, which is another $130 million.
Which the teachers are angry about.
The teachers are not happy.
They feel, but I heard, the way that Karen Lewis talked about it, she said it was retaliation, that this was, you know, that this is an act of war.
You know, this is one of the things, as an observer, you go back and forth to these things, to the mayor and CPS and the teachers. The CTU has so much bile and anger for everything that comes out of the mayor. You know, they said, we just don't trust you. Is the thing that is said. And when you say, I don't trust you, you're no longer talking about the issues. You're now talking about a personality.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, if you're no longer negotiating on the issues, you're now negotiating on a personality, you've got a real problem.
Well, I mean, they obviously have a long-standing sort of feud when it comes or issue with trust. Because they've been promised a lot of things, and there's been strikes and otherwise.
On the flip side, you know, Rahm has really had a tin ear on some of this stuff. You know, we were talking about the TIFs. Frankly, if he had said, you know what, okay, fine, I'll declare $200 million as a surplus. And if he had just done that, the truth is something's going to go, Rahm Emanuel, and he's got to pick what it is and get it in front. And I'm not sure that he's willing to do that. It's sort of like what happened with the McClellan-McDonald video controversy. Everyone knew that there was a video. Why didn't he just put it out and get it done with rather than make it turn into a horrible, horrible, horrible
thing? Well, let me ask you. I mean, this doesn't bode well for negotiations, what's happening this week. I mean, are we at the point now where it's inevitable the S word will be muttered around Chicago?
The thing that rhymes with pike? Yeah. Well, you know, I think that the way the teachers are talking, it's close to inevitable. They're able to strike within 100 days, or I'm sorry, after 100 days. But my thought in talking to various people is that they probably wouldn't strike until the fall for a number of reasons. One is that there's a lot of high school seniors and juniors who depend on scholarship money from athletics and other things that they need to do that are at the end of the year. And they could ruin a lot of kids.
And
who
they don't want
to transfer
they want
different
parents,
things.
They want parents on their side.
Exactly.
So they're not.
And if they strike
right
at the end of the school year, that will obliterate literally thousands of kids' chances in order to have a good education.
So you'd see this more at the beginning of the school year, like they did a couple
just
years
just like the last time. So I think we can anticipate that school will start for a week or so, and then they'll go on strike.
Well, this story obviously is not going anywhere, so we will talk more about that as it goes on.
Yep.
Let's make a quick transition to the political season is underway. The Iowa caucuses reminded us that on March 15th, we've got a primary.
Yeah,
in the state
wow
of Illinois.
Hey, cool.
Both Senate races are pretty much foregone conclusions that it's going to be Senator Kirk and it's going to be Tammy Duckworth. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I have to. When you get down the ballot, I guess there's going to be a smattering of different kind of legislative races. But the big one that everyone's paying attention to is Cook County State's Attorney.
That's right. So it's a three-way race between Donna Moore, who's white Caucasian, Kim Fox, who's African-American, and Anita Alvarez, who's Latina. And Anita Alvarez is the incumbent. Kim Fox is a former chief of staff for Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. And, you know, there was a poll put out by the Tribune the other day that showed Anita Alvarez in a pretty solid lead, which is not surprising. You know, incumbents tend to do a lot better. In a race like this, it's most people, oh yeah, today's turning, you know, and so people make a judgment based
it's
on
hard
name
to,
ID.
I get that, but right. This one. I mean, State's Attorney Alvarez is in the middle of one of the biggest stories in Chicago news history with the Laquan McDonald video, and she's sort of been drawn the ire of a lot of protesters. It feels to me that there's still a long way till March 15th, and that the State's Attorney Alvarez still has an uphill battle.
Yeah, I think that's true. Although I think a lot of people's memories when it comes to politics are like mayflies. You know, they've got right. something else that they care about. They're going all the time. And the other thing to remember is that in 2008, when Anita Alvarez was elected, she was in a scrum of a race. There were five candidates. She was way behind. And then she had an amazing television ad.
Yeah, right.
Which you can still find if you go to YouTube and look Anita Alvarez TV ad. And she just destroyed with that TV ad. Her husband is a very successful OB-GYN, and he took out a big loan, and they bought like $500,000 of TV. Hmm. So, you know, I think it's going to come down to one really good ad. Now, that being said, she's ahead in the money-raising race by about $140,000 from her nearest competitor.
And her nearest competitor is Kim Fox.
That's right.
Who didn't do so well with a piece in the Sun-Times just about – they're questioning her record in the courtroom.
She had a miserable interview with Dan Mialopoulos from the Sun-Times where asked her a whole bunch of questions about whether or not she's actually tried felony cases. And she really didn't purport herself very well. And Dan had a lot of information that showed that she really had no felony trial experience, very little felony trial experience.
Which may not be that big of a deal when it comes to being the state's attorney, because it is more and more of a political position.
You know, yes. Yeah, but, you know, you got to know how a courtroom works, but she clearly does.
So and the last question tonight has to do with, you know, the Iowa caucuses, you know, strong showing for Senator Rubio, strong showing for Senator Sanders on the Democrat side. Do you see in Illinois any evidence that they're using that bump to generate some excitement this far ahead?
There are people that are getting excited. But the thing about the presidential races is that it's very hard to say to voters, oh, this is going to be the person that you should get excited about and start rallying for in Illinois at this point for president. You know, we're still going to have New Hampshire next week, South Carolina and Nevada before the
Super Tuesday.
March 15th.
Is there a chance that we're irrelevant on both sides, that by the time we get to March 15th, the front runners are in?
There's certainly going to be Republican candidates that are going to drop out. And I think on the Republican side, there's going to be, you know, some changing in terms of who's going to be in the lead. And, you know, if Sanders wins in New Hampshire this next week, which I think he will, because it's his next door state, you know, that's going to give him even more of a bump. But then supposedly Clinton has a big lead in South Carolina.
Well, so she's going to win in the southern states. You know, that's so we were talking about this on Monday night, that he almost needed, even though it was really, really close, he needed to win Iowa to get that momentum going, that, you know, it's going to be a tough road for my
this stuff
senator.
Moves so fast.
Yeah, no, it's so fun, though, man.
Yeah.
This is the best game in town.
Best game
so
in town.
So fun.
Best game in town. I think Chicago, unfortunately, Chicago politics is the best game in town. Unfortunately.
It's great. And I have so many questions, maybe I'll save it for another time because we're running out of time here. But, I mean, I'm interested in what the Republican base here in Illinois does when it comes to president. I mean, are they a Ted Cruz conservative state?
I don't think they
Marco
know.
Marco Rubio and Jim
I don't
Bush,
think yeah. they know. I think that it's all over
Donald
the place.
Trump.
There are a lot of Trump supporters in Illinois.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that.
Touches the vibe. Although there's been a really interesting point that some other people have made, which is that Donald Trump isn't a real candidate. He's a TV reality show candidate. Mm-hmm. And people that are interested in him don't necessarily show up to the polls. They just want to watch cool
yeah,
stuff.
They're loving
TV.
It. And I wouldn't necessarily be surprised if he knows that in the way that, I mean, I think what's happening.
No,
I think he does.
Lizard brain,
because what I find interesting, I kind of made the joke at the beginning of the show, is that, you know, he is right on the Ted Cruz kind of dirty trick stuff in Iowa.
Absolutely.
And a lot of politicians would never talk about that stuff because they do it too. And he comes out and he's like, that's wrong. What you're doing is wrong. This is why politics is terrible.
Right.
This is why nobody likes
right.
you.
Well, the
and
reason
I, that's
he's
a good
not,
thing.
He's not doing it is because he doesn't really have a campaign operation.
Yeah, I know.
So he's
But it's,
he's not
it's
doing
refreshing
any of
that stuff. In the way that, I mean, the other stuff on television, all that kind of stuff's not refreshing, but it's refreshing to have candidates go, this is what he did. Take a look at what he did.
I like your impression.
I like
him,
it.
By the way.
Nah,
that's pretty good.
It's nothing.
That's really good.
It's yeah.
Maybe
you.
I'll do
thank
my
you.
Ted Kennedy.
Go
no,
ahead.
No.
Go ahead.
No. 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 I'll do my Massachusetts. I lived in Massachusetts for a while, so I learned how to talk like those
go,
people.
There you go.
They got you get better service at the 7-Eleven when you talk like them.
Mike Fouché is the man behind AlderTrack.com, subscription newsletter that covers all things Chicago and Springfield politics. Good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up later in the 9 o'clock hour, Kevin Pang's going to be here. Kevin, of course, former Chicago Tribune food reporter who turned filmmaker. His film For Grace is actually now available for download on iTunes, Amazon. This is the movie that was about Curtis Duffy, the chef, and his restaurant Grace, about his childhood, very tumultuous childhood, to becoming one of the most successful chefs in the world. So we'll talk to Kevin about that this big week for him. Also, John Jughead Pearson is back. John is the guitar player for Screeching Weasel. He's also a ensemble member of the Neo-Futurists at the Neo-Futurarium up in Andersonville. He's celebrating 20 years with that company. And just this week, I think on Friday, he flies back to Japan to continue his work as a wizard. And I'm not joking. That is, we're going to talk to him about what it takes to be a wizard. He's a wizard. He's a Japanese wizard. The guitar player for the punk rock band Screeching Weasel is now a Japanese wizard. So we will talk with him coming up about that. My guest tonight at the big table once held a pretty prestigious job. She was the Midwest director of the Environmental Protection Agency. And back in 2008, she moved very quickly to deal with a contaminated water crisis in a small Michigan town. Sound familiar? Well, the difference here is that Mary Gady was reprimanded and eventually removed from her post stemming from that response. Hard to believe, since the latest Midwest EPA administrator was removed for not acting faster in Flint, Michigan. Gady has dedicated her life to the environment. She served with the Illinois EPA. She served under President George W. Bush and his father. Well, and you know, she continues to work as a president of her own Chicago-based consultant agency, Gady Environmental Group. So tonight we talk environment, disaster, politics, and preparedness with Mary Gady. Mary, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just talk about Flint, Michigan, because this is one of these stories that we continue to see and more comes out. I mean, hearings today, you've been outspoken on this about the role of the EPA. You've had an interesting past, and we'll talk about it in a little bit, but what's your take on what's going on here? I mean, the EPA obviously does not look good.
Well, there's blame to go around, so that it starts at the city level and the emergency manager appointed by the governor of the state, who made the fateful decision to switch from treated Detroit water that had been serving the populace for decades to untreated Flint River water, and that's where the problem began. It might not have become such a problem if the laws had been enforced in the city of Flint and by the state of Michigan, which requires corrosion control, which would have helped prevent this more acidic water from leaching lead out of the pipes and into the drinking water of taps.
Let me ask, because when I hear that, I think, what recourse or what role can the EPA play when municipalities and governments make decisions like these? I mean, you really can't step in necessarily and say, that's going to be bad.
No, and that's correct. You're not going to step in and substitute your judgment for that of the city government
right.
in making that decision. But you are going to ensure that the federal laws, and this is a federal law, the Safe Drinking Water Act is a federal law, is adequately implemented and enforced. And that's what didn't happen here. The state failed to fulfill its responsibility as a delegated program from the federal government to implement the law in the way it was supposed to be, force the city of Flint to do the appropriate corrosion control, do the sampling in a way that was appropriate, and make those results transparent to the population. So that was a failure of a delegated federal program. When a state doesn't do its job, the EPA retains its federal authority to take action.
Now, there's some, you know, I don't know, like just sort of gray area when they talk about delegation and whether or not you can the EPA can come in and take control and that kind of thing. And it's been thrown around in Flint, Michigan. But they do have the power and the authority to say, we're in charge.
Yeah, totally. These are federal laws. And in fact, the primary people that are responsible for it are the people that work at US EPA. It's only when a state demonstrates that it's got the appropriate regulations, staff, capacity, ability to implement it, and it's a whole laborious process by which they get authority to run the program mm-hmm. in lieu of the federal government, does a state take over. But they are still not the only people responsible. It's still a federal program. And so EPA still does oversight. They step in and sometimes file enforcement actions when they think the state isn't acting. It's actually an ongoing sort of battle between states and the EPA about who's got control of these delegated programs.
Let me ask you, because the thing I think that grabs everybody's attention is the idea that any town in America can have this kind of problem with their water, especially a town that is in the shadow of a lake like Huron. You know, the other part is political. The part that, you know, it becomes more and more clear as people do investigations that the bureaucrats and the politicians knew this was happening far before the people did, or, you know, the country. Talk about both of the how politically something like this can happen, where, I mean, whose job is it to sort of come in, step in right when they find out and say, let's get this done?
Well, I don't think politics goes into that. That's where the bureaucrats have an obligation under the law, a real legal obligation to notify the public about the sampling results that they're getting and any adverse health effects. So the first failure here is in terms of that, is not political. It is of the bureaucrats charged with that responsibility not to do the things they were supposed to do. And that's both at the state level, and then when they fail to do it, it's at the federal level.
So the politics comes in when people start covering stuff up.
That's right. And I mean, I'm one of those people that believe strongly that the environment should be a nonpartisan issue or a bipartisan issue if you're in support of it. It's like education for me. And so the fact that it's become a little bit of a political football, and it was today in the hearings in Washington, D.C., is painful for me. This is an issue that we need to come together on.
We're talking with Mary Gady. She's the former Midwest director of the EPA, and she served until 2008. When we come back, I want to talk more about your time at the EPA and get a better sense and understanding of what it's like to work in that bureaucracy, in that federal program. Because, you know, we've heard so much about what they can and can't do. I'd love to know how it works, what can be done. You know, so many things we can learn from someone who used to run it. Mary Gady, my guest tonight in the Big Table. Stay with us. This is Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the Big Table, Mary Gady. She's the former Midwest director of the EPA. She also served at the Illinois level under Governor Edgar, the Illinois EPA, and she now runs her own consultant agency, Gady Environmental Group. Mary, you spent your whole—I mean, you've really made a career out of being involved with the environmental protection.
That's correct. I first got interested in it, believe it or not, in 1970 on the first Earth Day, when my high school put together an Earth Day program, and I helped at it. And
wow.
So I realized at that point how interesting it was, how important it was, and how it could be a fascinating career.
When you got into the career, I mean, you've done a lot of you've been a public servant. You've worked in the like I just said under Governor Edgar. Talk about how you got involved with being a public servant and working for the state.
Well, as I said, for me, it's always been a fascinating area because the environment covers everything. So you can be, as I am, an environmental attorney, or you can be a biologist, a chemist, somebody that focuses on communications. There is just a whole variety of things that are included in environmental protection. And so I knew that it was an area I wanted to get involved in, and I had the good fortune, to be hired early on in my career by US EPA Region 5 and started out as a staff air attorney. Working on some really interesting cases.
You have a very sort of mailroom to the top story.
I do in terms of EPA. It's true, because I started out just as a staff attorney and made my way up through the ranks and then ended up in Washington, D.C. as the Deputy Assistant Administrator for the nation's hazardous and solid waste program.
So one of the great things about your vantage point, I mean, you've served under so many different administrations, but you've also served in so many different decades of this country's sort of, and I mean it in the way that you've seen attitudes change.
in the way that it makes me.
Yeah,
look
old. I know. No. But I mean, but you've seen this country, even from, you know, the first Earth Day to what we see today. I mean, you've seen the attitudes change, and when it comes to protecting the environment that we live in.
I know, and it's been fascinating for me because people tend to forget we have done such a good job in this country collectively and by implementing the laws that the U.S. Congress passed of cleaning up our environment, that people forget that 40 years ago, you could hardly drive along the tip of Lake Michigan on a sunny afternoon without your headlights on because of the pollution from it. They forget that the mm-hmm. Cuyahoga River burned with regularity until we put in place the Clean Water Act protections. We forget, and we forget how many ozone days we had in Chicago in terms of bad air quality.
Right.
And so the important thing is to understand it's because we have very rigorously enforced our environmental laws that we have such a clean and healthy environment today. And I think sometimes that works to our disadvantage because people don't understand the importance of continuing to enforce those laws.
Well, this is an interesting state when it comes to the environment. I mean, you served under Governor Edgar, and this is a state that has a lot of interest in coal. Downstate, you have a lot of coal. You have a lot of, even if you just talk about the region, I mean, just right across the border in Indiana, a ton of industry, steel industry, that kind of thing. But there's a real relationship with manufacturing here. And a lot of the manufacturers, especially the big ones that create a lot of jobs, they also create a lot of pollution. So talk about the state of Illinois and that sort of give and take that we've had in our history over the years.
Well, I mean, there is no doubt it's a big state. It's one of the older manufacturing states in the country. We clearly have coal in the southern part of the state, and we have a lot of agriculture. And so we have a lot of diverse economic sectors in the state. But one of the things that I think has gone forward well in Illinois is that we have put in place laws that are fair and that get the job done. So that Illinois has an incredibly good track record in terms of protecting the health of our citizens.
Let me ask you, so after the Illinois EPA, you went back to Washington. You were in 2006, you were brought in to be the Midwest director here in Chicago under George W. Bush. But you were the Midwest director, and you know, at that time, you had to deal with the same kind of issues that we're kind of seeing in Flint, Michigan, when a big manufacturer maybe has a pollution runoff into the rivers, things like that. You had your own sort of crisis that you had to take on. Talk about your relationship to the issue I'm talking about with Dow Chemicals.
Well, there's a little bit of similarity, no doubt, to what happened to me when I was running the EPA in 2006 and as this current crisis in Flint. And that is that I was sitting at my desk one day when my staff came and said that routine sampling under the law that protects against hazardous waste being put where it shouldn't be, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, that routine sampling by Dow Chemical in the Tittabawassee River had turned up a sample of 87,000 parts per trillion of dioxin. And dioxin is a known cancer-causing compound. It's a byproduct of industrial manufacturing of things like Agent Orange. And the Dow facility in Midland, Michigan had been manufacturing it, and air pollution and water pollution had caused this excessive level of dioxin in the river. The health-based standard at that point was 10 parts per billion.
And so what'd you do?
It was orders of magnitude. And so I looked at my staff, who were understandably very concerned about it. We were aghast. We got Dow on the telephone immediately and said, you need to come up with a plan to address this.
So that's how you usually do it. You go to the company and say, you got to come. What's your plan?
Exactly. And when they failed to come up with one by the spring, because it was the winter and there was not a lot you could do about cleaning up a river system in the middle of the winter, we used for the first time ever the kind of authority that the region could have used or EPA could have used earlier in this case, order authority, and said there's an imminent and substantial endangerment to the health of the people in this river system. You have X number of days to tell us whether you're going to clean it up under a plan we approve, or we're going to do it.
Well, I got to ask the question. I mean, how did Dow Chemicals react? I mean, they're a very big company with a lot of interests. I mean, they probably didn't like that the EPA was telling them they had to clean it up.
I think they were surprised because it had been years of inaction and years of stalling by the company on a variety of things. They're very adept at playing the system and figuring out ways to extend things or submit things in an incomplete fashion that it causes you to do yet another draft and whatever. But I will say at about 10 o'clock on the last day in which they were supposed to tell us whether they were going to do it or not, a cadre of their attorneys walked into the regional office of EPA with a signed agreement.
Mary Gady, you're a freedom fighter. You're an environmental freedom fighter.
I think I was doing my job with my staff.
Well, okay, so we're going to take a break and get to the news. And we'll come back and talk about what were the repercussions of that move? Because, you know, it's so interesting to me because it would seem on paper that anyone who works at the Environmental Protection Agency is going to jump in and try to take care of something like that because that's what you're protecting. But it's not that easy, especially when it comes to bureaucracy and politics. And you've found out quickly in the next couple of years about what standing up for the environment was going to cost you. We'll come back. We'll talk with Mary Gady. She was the former Midwest director of the EPA, and she is my guest tonight on The Download. Thanks for being here, and stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. With me, Mary Gady. She's the former Midwest director of the EPA. She's my guest tonight at the big table. She served everywhere. She served at the Illinois EPA. She served under President George W. Bush as the Midwest director. And she now runs her Chicago-based consultant agency, Gady Environmental Group. We're talking about Flint, Michigan. But you know what? It's bigger than Flint, Michigan, because you have a story that's similar. Because in your case, when you had to deal with a contamination issue, it's not the same as the water issue, but a contamination issue of a river system that was connected to Dow Chemicals, and you did it. You forced Dow Chemicals to come up with a plan, and that's where we ended the story before we went to the news, that they came in and signed. What happens after that?
Well, this was different in the sense of this was contamination in the sediments of the Tittabawassee River system. And so what essentially we did is we ordered them to clean up these hot spots, which they did over the course of many months. In the course of that sampling, we found another horrifying hot spot of 1.6 million parts per trillion. And the standard, again, is 10 parts per trillion. So we added yet another order to this.
I mean, this is a big story. I mean, this was because there were so many stories at the time and even before that of you know, chemical companies, other manufacturers, just sort of skirting the law, being able to dump stuff in the river systems. And that's like sort of a known American story, if not an Earth story. But yeah, so you took action.
I took action. But in fairness to companies, remember, we didn't have these kind of stringent environmental laws until the 1970s. So a lot of the damage was done before these laws were in place. So then the issue is people who were culpable for that, for that, coming forward to clean it up and make sure.
And
that
it costs money and they don't want to spend the money. That's pretty much it, right? So what happens? Because, you know, I tease this story out that there are repercussions. Not too long after, you're asked for your resignation. Talk about that.
We used our order authority to compel cleanup of the river system in these hot spots. That did indeed happen. And then we knew that as we continued to do our investigation, we found out that a 50-mile swath of Michigan all the way to Lake Huron from Midland, Michigan, was contaminated. And actually leading into the lake. And so we knew that there were going to be many more cleanups necessary, including in the city of Midland itself. And so in the course of doing that, obviously it cost a great deal of money, and the company, I think, became very unhappy about the way it was going and the pressure that was being put on them to clean up the site. And at a certain point in the process, in which my staff and I were very committed to the cleanup of this and moving forward, I was asked to resign.
And it wasn't necessarily like this was 2008, but this was before the Obama administration. I mean, you were working under George W. Bush. So this was the administration coming to you who was running the EPA at the time saying
we have a policy disagreement. You want to do this and we don't want to do that, or we want to do it differently. I am pleased to say, and especially with the hardworking staff at Region 5 that really did all the work on this, that even today the cleanup continues in that area of the country, and there's been cleanups in the city of a lot of residential lots over the last couple of years and city parks. It's an area in which there's everywhere has been posted no fishing, no drinking, no swimming, no whatever. It's very contaminated.
Let me ask you, as a person, when we set this story up that you spent your life in environmental protection, working a lot for the state, for the government. Were you surprised that your actions led to a sort of an ask of your resignation?
Yeah, I was surprised, actually, because I felt that we were fundamentally doing what we were charged with doing. That when you take a job as a regional administrator, you actually swear an oath to uphold the laws of this country, and clearly that's what we were doing. So, yes, I was surprised.
So, you know, making a transition back to what's happening in Flint, Michigan, one of the big issues with that story is inaction. It's the exact opposite of what happened with you. Is there any way, and I'm sure you're going to say no, but is there any way that your story is lore? in the way that, you know, that administrators and the EPA, they're like, well, you know, you don't want to act too fast. You saw what happened to Mary.
I don't think so. I think they're really quite different situations. And that would be really inexcusable, because then you wouldn't be fulfilling your responsibility to the public to watch out for their health and safety. I don't understand what happened. And I think as the weeks go by and the investigations and the oversight hearings and the emails and whatever come out, we will all get a better understanding of what was going on. But from what I have seen, I think that EPA in this instance was trying to deal in a very plotting, bureaucratic way with the problem. And so they were trying to address the underlying problem with the lack of corrosion control in the Flint water system. They were trying to deal with MDEQ's sort of intransigence in terms of how to deal with the samples.
So essentially paperwork. They were doing paperwork.
They were dealing with underlying issues, but they, in the course of that, lost sight of what the heck these poor people were drinking and the real crisis and public health crisis that was emerging that required emergency action.
So the issue, and I think that's what the hearings are about, is and the hearings are becoming more political than bureaucratic. But the issue really, it wasn't the fact that the EPA was short on resources or couldn't, and that they just, it's not that they chose not to, they just didn't do it. They could have done it.
Absolutely. So the authorities are vast. And I mean, I used many of them with my staff back in 2006 through 8 and the Dow Midland, Michigan crisis. And these are things like issuing the order authority that was finally issued by EPA on January 21st of 2016, which could have been issued months and months ago, compelling the city and state to
do certain things. There's talk that they knew what was happening and even double-checked what was happening by early summer.
Well, concretely at senior levels they did, and we'll find out more as more documentation comes out. But EPA itself knew as early as February, clearly as early as February. A year ago, 2015, that there were elevated levels, significantly elevated levels.
Now, they'll say that they went and did, and like you did, they went and said, okay, to the Michigan government, and they said, what's your plan? They said, and the Michigan government fibbed a little bit.
Well, I mean, I can only tell what I saw today in the hearing, and they held up an email of the state in which the state assured EPA that the appropriate corrosion control that would have prevented the lead from leaching from the pipes was in place. And so that was clearly a misrepresentation. But meanwhile, because of the way the program works, the EPA is aware of the sampling results that the city water department was required to do under the Safe Drinking Water Act. And so EPA had its own knowledge of what was going on.
It's fascinating. I mean, obviously, you've been vocal. You've been active in talking about this because, you know, you were I think it was a commentary or an editorial in one of the Detroit newspapers. You've talked a lot about this. I mean, as a person who has been involved with the government, involved with EPA, when you see something like this happen and it gets to the point where it's at, where there's just a whole system of drinking water is not available for people, and I mean, this is a full-blown crisis, what goes through your mind?
I mean, I've used the words horrified, appalled, aghast more in the last 2 weeks than I ever have in my life. There's not words to explain how upsetting this is to somebody knows what could have been done and should have been done. And so we talked about the fact that there's emergency order authority. When we were dealing with the Dow crisis, we called in the Centers for Disease Control. We went out and did our own sampling. There are many instances across this country in which you find sources of contamination impacting drinking water wells, and the EPA gives out notices immediately, provides alternative water supplies, bottled water, tanker trucks, whatever. None of that happened here, and that's really a failure, I believe, of leadership.
Mary Gady is the former Midwest director of the EPA. Let's take a break. When we come back, I'd love to talk to you more about our water supply. Because, you know, I don't know much about it. You just mentioned, you know, when this thing happens, when there's well problems, they slap something, tankers come in. How often this happens? Also, the effect of old pipes and lead on the water supply, which, you know, I was reading something that this is not. I mean, the idea that they are testing and certain people are coming back positive, that's just the tip of the iceberg. This has been a year. Michael Moore talked about, you know, he was drinking the water and taking showers and doing things in Flint, Michigan, and would have been exposed to this. So there's a lot that goes into this story. So let's continue the conversation with Mary Gady when we return here in The Download. Stay with us. Three-one-two says, thank you, Mary, for all that you've done. I appreciate it. Isn't that nice to hear?
That's very nice to hear.
I would say an EPA administrator doesn't usually get that kind of...
Not often.
Talking with Mary Gady. She's a former Midwest director of the EPA. She was forced to resign in 2008 over a difference of, I guess it was philosophy or policy in the cleanup of a contaminated area of Michigan. Dow Chemicals was a big story at the time. And we're talking about Flint, Michigan. And we're talking about the environment in general. You know, I always feel like that this is happening all the time. That Flint, Michigan is happening all the time, and we don't hear about it because it doesn't all, you know, you always, like, if you get on Facebook and you have yet one friend from high school is like, look what's happening in Arkansas, nobody's talking about it. Or are all the kind of environmental concerns that we have. I mean, I kind of see the EPA as almost like the black ops of environmental protection. How often does something like Flint, Michigan happen where there's like lead in the water or there's some sort of contamination that we don't even know about?
Well, I mean, we hope Flint is an anomaly and doesn't happen very often. But, I mean, I've already read reports that there's some similar incident going on in Ohio. We know that in 2001, there was elevated lead levels found in the Washington, D.C.'s water because they switched the corrosion treatment they were using. So we know that this happens, but we know primarily the problem with lead in water is a function of our aging infrastructure and the fact that until really the 1990s, we didn't ban using lead pipes or filters in our systems, our water supply systems. In fact, many places you were ordered to use lead pipes. And so in Flint, they have 600 miles at least of lead service lines. We have a lot of them in Chicago.
Yeah, right.
And so you need to do this corrosion control because it's your best line of defense against the lead.
And this isn't new to the federal government. The federal government understands the dangers of lead. We saw it in lead paint. We saw it in, you know, lead is the gas. We've seen lead become public enemy number one. It's in pipes, but the federal government knows of this problem.
Yes, of course. And the Safe Drinking Water Act has a specific rule dedicated to, it's called the Lead and Copper Rule, the LCR, and it has specific provisions about how to prevent lead from coming off the pipes into the drinking water supply system, which is by applying something called optimal corrosion control, which is generally applying, for example, in the Detroit system, which had been feeding Flint their water for decades, they were using something called orthophosphate. So it was a phosphate, and over time, it coats the interior of the pipe and prevents the lead from sloughing off. And that's what happened when the Swiss system switched. The city of Flint switched in 2014 to Flint River water,
right,
not treated water. They did not use any of that corrosion control.
You're going to see more of this, Mary, right? You're going to see more because as the infrastructure crumbles and the resources are much more limited for local governments, for federal funds, you know, as we really become cash strapped. Well, are we going to see more of the kind of crumbling infrastructure become environmental problems?
Well, I think that there are safeguards in place, but one of the problems here has been, and many people have complained about this and talked about it, the lead and copper rule that is supposed to provide all these safeguards is almost 25 years old. It was written by EPA in 1991. Many people believe it has too many loopholes in terms of how you do the sampling to test these systems to see if they're secure. They lower the concentrations that are actually there and have all sorts of other problems. EPA has been talking for many years about updating that law. Gina McCarthy, the administrator of US EPA, has just announced that they will accelerate that process.
So they have to, right? I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. And so what needs to happen is, quite honestly, people don't have to worry if the laws that the agencies are enforcing are good. And they're doing their job. And in fact, because of the concern of lead, there is no safe level of lead exposure. None. Zero. You don't want any lead in your system. You don't want to be exposed to it in any way. But what needs to happen is that the people in charge of this, the water supply systems, are supposed to notify their customers of the sample results. They're required to do 2 6-month samplings every year. They need to put that out in a message to their customers. It's that kind of transparency that has been missing here. And so one of the things that needs to happen is we need to assure that people are following the existing laws,
right,
and then make them more strong.
Like a lot of things, I mean, it's an uphill battle because you're dealing with a lot, like I said, a lot of cash-strapped communities and less state funding, things of that nature. Let me ask you, too, about philosophy, because we see all the time with the EPA and more importantly with the environment, when I think of things like climate change and so forth, this sort of idea that it's polarizing, that it's partisan. you have spent your life under Republican administrations. You, Governor Edgar here in Illinois, George W. Bush as a president. But you are a Republican. You've talked about that. Do you feel like that's an accurate stereotype, the idea that there is, it's a partisan issue and that the left believes that the right doesn't care? And we see all the clips that come on and somebody saying, I've got a snowball in Congress. Like, talk about the relationship between politics and the environment.
Well, I think it's more partisan, obviously. Anybody who watches what's going on in Washington understands that environment is a political football in Washington, but not to the average American. Poll after poll in the United States shows that all Americans believe that clean air, clean water, you know, safe food supply is important to them.
Yeah.
And so they're not quibbling about the need for environmental protection. And that's also true in terms of climate change. Poll after poll is showing that the majority of Americans thinks we need to take appropriate action to safeguard against it. So it should not be a partisan issue. The fact that it has become one is very, very tragic.
Yeah, why do you think it? I mean, it almost feels like the Environmental Protection Agency is something that people go after when they become, you know, when we switch administrations. Like, the Environmental Protection Agency needs to do this now that I'm president, or this if I'm president. Why do you think it is? Why can't we just this be like almost separate from administration?
Well, we've always said when we're in the EPA that we're doing a good job if everyone is suing us, because. Because you're the enforcer of the laws, and so you're
right.
Putting, you know, you're issuing permits, you're out there causing companies to have to incur costs to put in safeguards, control equipment, whatever. So you're not popular. So it's easy to come after you in sort of a very generic way that you're being too rigorous and you're doing bad things. And then, of course, the minute that you aren't doing the things you should do, they come after you and say you failed.
I mean, we're seeing that what happened with you in 2008. And we're seeing what happened here in 2016. I mean, they're different sides or polar opposites, but the same issue of like trying to find that balance of what is appropriate for the Environmental Protection
Agency. Yeah, Justin, I think you've captured something, which is a certain schizophrenia in the system of and the attitudes about the EPA.
Mary, I mean, I ask my guests all the time on this segment in the Big Table just about Chicago. And, you know, just what it means to you as a person who lives here. But I want to ask you, as someone who's been a part of, you know, say, sort of protecting the environment, how is Chicago? Is Chicago and the people that live here, are we environmentally conscious? Are we ahead of the curve?
Absolutely. Chicago's got an amazing sustainability program. It's been in place now. Mayor Daley started it. Mayor Emanuel's continued it. I mean, I urge people to go online and look at the current sustainability report for the city of Chicago that just came out in December. Some remarkably good things are happening here. I think that Illinois and the city of Chicago have taken environment very seriously.
Good. So you're not going to go anywhere else? You're going to stay with us
in
Chicago?
I love this city.
Good. We need people like you, Mary. Mary Gady is the former Midwest director of the Environmental Protection Agency. She's worked at the Illinois EPA. She worked under President George W. Bush and President George H.W. Bush, right? And also, you're a Chicago-based consultant with the agency Gady Environmental Group. Mary Gady, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your story tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Justin.
All right, it's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. One of my first guests on this show is leaving town again. Mm-hmm. Just like you're leaving town all the time. John Jughead Pearson has lived several creative lives. He's the founder and guitar player for the Chicago punk band Screeching Weasel, a writer and performer for the Neo-Futurists, Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind, and he's an author. He's written several books with the local publisher Hope and Non-Things. He's a world traveler, and he's heading back to Japan this week, or beginning of next week,
yes,
for a 7-month stint as a wizard. John, good to see you, man.
Good to see you, Justin, always.
All right, before we start, is I want to find out about the wizard stuff, because when you were on before, we spent a good 5 minutes looking at your wand. That's
we
not,
did.
That's not
it was
a euphemism. That's what we did.
Yeah, we did look at my wand.
We looked at your wand.
It was a birch wand, but also in Japanese, it's kabanoki.
Okay, before we start, you were supposed to be on last week,
yes,
and you know, we were going back and forth, and you're like, oh, I'm stuck because of the storm in Dublin or Ireland. That's where mm-hmm. you were. Then you went on Facebook and you read this long thing about how you almost died on the plane. Like, did you like they had to like go twice and try to land? Explain this.
Well, we couldn't get out of Dublin, so they weren't doing any flights to Newark, and you have to go to Newark to get to Chicago. So I flew to London to get a flight back to Chicago from there. And the plane was a really small plane. And those small planes, you know, they you could tell you're going fast and they shake a lot. But it started shaking. It was about to land. It was rocking back and forth. And then right at the last moment, it zoomed right back up in the air and like shot way back up in the air.
Oh, God.
And then the guy came on and said, "We're going to give that another try. So just hold tight. We'll get you landed soon." And then we circled for like another 10 minutes. You know how dizzying it is to get circling around. He came back down, same thing, shook from side to side, side to side, about to hit the end of like a pylon at the end, and then zoomed right back up again.
What the? I mean, what was going on? What were the passengers doing? What were you doing?
Surprisingly, I mean, they're all like, I think, British proper people.
Have you ever been involved in like a plane kind of thing like that? No.
Not to that
turbulence,
extent.
No, right.
Turbulence, yeah.
Right,
but this was...
This is real deal.
Most bizarre. I've never gotten that close to landing, and then twice. Then he said it's illegal for them to try a third pass, so we had to go to another airport, and then they closed down that
airport.
What
was the problem? What was the problem?
I didn't know, but a lot of people were responding to my post saying it was crosswinds. And as we all know, like a lot of accidents don't really happen much, but in the moment you don't.
Yeah, right.
You're just thinking about your life. And I was telling people how I really was in my head. I was very calm, but I was like, I think if we're going to die, I'm going to say I love this guy next to me and give him a hug. That's what I decided.
That's
I was
what
going
you decided?
Do. That's what I decided.
I mean, really, in your head, you're like, okay, so we have now done this twice. This is totally surreal.
I know he's going to need it. I'm going
to
need it.
And you're like, I need to hug this dude.
Yes.
Wow.
I'm not even joking. That's exactly what came to my head.
I always
want
to kind of
calm
it's kind of, you know, like I want to talk to you. I was going to talk to you about going back to Japan and talk about being a wizard. And I saw that on Facebook and I'm like, God, I wonder what Pearson was thinking. And now we know. Now Chicago knows.
Yeah.
Jughead was going to marry the guy that's next to him. That's great. Okay. Good. All right. So let's talk about you're going back. I mean, I've teased this out throughout the show that you're Chicago's, you're maybe the only wizard that we have. What do I mean?
There actually now there is one more wizard who is from Chicago. His name's Pete.
He sounds like a poser.
Oh, he doesn't look like a wizard like I do.
You do look like a wizard.
He doesn't have the beard. It's no hair.
What are you doing?
I work for the Japanese version of the Universal Studios Harry Potter World. And I do a show where I sell wands to Japanese individuals. But it's a one person show, about 5 minutes, and I do it about 20 to 30 times a day.
And you did this we talked to you in June maybe, or maybe it was a little earlier, May.
Yeah,
you just come back from that.
Yeah, I did it a year straight, and then they asked me to come back. So I was lucky.
Was it a hard decision to go back? I mean, you had spent a year in Japan.
Well, it was a hard decision because they want you to stay for a while, and I knew I had to come back, so I knew I had to work out a way to get back, so that was kind of the deal.
For you, I mean, now doing this a second stint, you know, what are you going to bring back? I mean, now that you're not a rookie anymore, we talked about sort of adjusting to the culture last time.
Yeah.
Just about, you know, being an American and English, you didn't know much Japanese, if any.
No.
Talk about, like, now you're going, you're a veteran now. You're back.
Like, I kind of feel like I am. I think I understand them a little bit more. I love the country. The job is getting a little tiring. It's hard. It's hard to do. I mean, I'm an improviser like you. To do the same show 100 times a week is kind of difficult.
And you don't really get much leeway to change the script.
No, you don't. Not with Universal Studios. But the guys who've been there for 2 years are. That was what was nice. I did actually go back a second time for 2 months. It's my third time back.
Oh, your third time. Okay.
And they even said that it was nice to have someone come back with some life again because they've been doing it straight for 2 years. So.
Wow. That's an amazing thought to spend that much time doing one thing and for you to be able to do it in the next 7 months in a foreign country that you're not that, at least you had a couple stints before.
Right. But it's not even in a language we really speak. Like none of them speak Japanese outside of the room really. So it's kind of, in a way, it's kind of like speaking nonsense 10 hours a day.
What are you going to do differently this time around?
I'm really getting into, now that I know the script well, I'm really getting into getting the accent down. I've been told that I'm really good because all I knew was like Japanese old movies, so I do it very big, and that's kind of what they like. Some people try to do it realistically, and they like the big. So I'll keep that up, but I want to get the little up inflexes and down inflexes better.
Do you have a sample? Do you have a sample sentence for us? I hate to put, I never like to put performers on the spot, but this is too rich, man.
Yeah, there's Kabanoki de Dekitatsue. So you have to go, Kabanoki has to go up and Dekitatsue comes down.
Tatsue.
And tsue. It's like, it's almost like they're just spitting it
and
out.
And that's, we that's have wand. Them in red and blue.
Yeah, no, that's, it's, this is a birch wand.
John Jughead Pierce is my guest.
Can I tell one more joke?
Yes, of course. Yes, please. And then, yeah, we're gonna say, tell. Let's wrap up. Let's wrap up Japan with one more joke.
With I have to ask my guest when it's their birthday. I go Otanjobi wa, which means when's your birthday, and they tell me. And then later on, I start this monologue by saying Oribanda no tsui wa subate, which means Ollivander wands are everywhere. And one day, I just stood back and said Otanjobi wa, which I means I wished everyone a happy birthday.
And they're like, thank you. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
John Pearson, Jughead, the, you know, I mean, pop or punk royalty here in Chicago from his time with Screeching Weasel.
Yes.
Even when Blackouts also, we'll talk about when we come back, 20 years at the Neo-Futurist.
Yes, 20
That's
years.
Crazy to think about, man. I mean, we've known each other for a long time. To be 20 years as an ensemble member at that show, and that show is amazing. And talk, you're just, I think you're just a glutton for the idea of doing things in repetition, man. 20 years of doing that show, to do a late night show, to be in that, I mean, you've gone in and out,
but
there's still a lot of, how many shows you think you've done?
Oh, I don't even know. Right. I really honestly
I'm going
to
give
know.
You a 3-minute break
and
here,
I'll try to think
and then you
that.
Got 3 minutes to think about okay. it, and it's got to be in Japanese.
Okay.
We just have to have you back periodically so we play some punk music on the show, yeah? What's that? Feel like we're what was that McGregor's? I feel like we're back at what was it?
McGregor's.
Yeah, McGregor's. Yeah, McGregor's. Yeah. That's where I feel like I'm at right now.
McGregor's. Wow.
Instead, we're on Michigan Avenue in the fishbowl here at
not
the
in
WGN
Elmhurst.
Radio. Not in Elmhurst in a weird club. John Jughead Pearson, my guest tonight, the guitarist and I guess they call you co-founder of Screeching Weasel.
Yeah, definitely.
Also celebrating a 20-year anniversary as an ensemble member to Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind.
Yes.
The Neo-Futurists. Also, I mean, just we were just talking about in the break with Screeching Weasel. I mean, you started performing right out of high school in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
So really, this is a 30-year anniversary of you being on stage.
Yes, that's true, yeah.
How does it feel for you? I mean, it's amazing that you've dedicated your life to show.
It's odd because I fought being a performer. I don't know why. My dad was a failed performer, salesman, so I didn't want to pursue it. But then everything I was doing was leading that way. Like I never planned for college, never even thought about being out of high school. So when the opportunity came up to start a band, I just did it.
For you, I mean, and I want to talk about not only the Neo-Futurist, but Den Theater, the 20th anniversary of your show that got you to Neo-Futurist.
Yes.
We'll talk about that too. But I'm fascinated by the idea of, I mean, there really hasn't been in your life since 1986, like an extended period of time where you haven't been on stage. I mean, you've done, Screeching Weasel was a nonstop tour. Mm-hmm. You guys are playing every week, you know, that kind of thing. And then you made the transition into theater, which is every Friday and Saturday night, if not Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Yeah.
I mean, really, if you think about it, have you thought about the idea that you, like, are constantly on stage?
Well, even during the Weasel, I was doing Hope and Non Things, but it started out as my production company. So I would come back from tours and then produce a play and then go back on tour. So I was one record for one play for about 15 records and 15 plays.
When you think about that, I mean, you've dedicated your life to that craft. I mean,
yeah.
to several creative crafts, but the craft of being performing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean, for people out there who maybe, you know, wanted to get into it or don't understand what draws people to it, what draws you to continue? I mean, you're about to leave to go to Japan to perform in a show that's every single day for 7 months.
Yeah, I was, you know, I used to think it was a lack of something, actually. Like, I had nothing that said I couldn't do it myself. And I still feel that's kind of a lack because I'm not really good at any one thing, so I haven't been able to give up a few things to be perfect at any one thing. But there's nothing in me that's ever said not to try something. So
is it at all a curse to you? Do you ever feel like, oh man, I wish I didn't do this.
I often have to tell people that creativity comes before a lot of things in my life, and there's periods in my life where I don't have any money, or you know, I struggle a lot. But at the end of the day, that's most important to me, not the money or anything like that. So.
That's a good way to put it. That creativity comes before, and you talk a lot about, you hear people talking about. Oh, I just read this. About commitment, you know, like the commitment to the art or commitment to the arts.
Yes.
You know, it comes with the fact that there's going to be some situations that, you know, you're going to have difficult situations maybe with relationships or with other things because you're always in this sort of relationship with your art.
Yeah. And I remember being in Columbia College here and seeing that. You could see it in some people's eyes that were, this was just a time in college until they, you know, found a job somewhere. And then there was the ones that were like, we're doing this. We're getting out of here. We're going to start our own company. We're going to keep moving on. And I try to hook up with many of those people as I can along the way. So,
you know, it's funny because you and I have known each other for a long time, and we've been on the same stages at times and things like that. And I saw this article. I want to get your take on it because I saw this article today popped in Facebook. I think it was Sia, the artist Sia. She said all the artists – they were talking about how she covers her face. She doesn't show her face when she performs. And they were grilling her on it and some question and answer. She said, all artists who get up on stage, especially in Hollywood, are insecure. Or that's just what it is. I'm insecure and I cover my face and that's what it is. But all artists that do this, because we've been dancing forever. Something like that. We've been dancing forever. What do you take? What's your take on that?
Well, first I say any statement that says all is wrong to begin with because you only know your own perception.
Right.
So you could say, well, my point of view, you know.
Right.
I don't know. I have insecurities. I do
no,
feel
yeah,
there's something
too, but,
to that.
Yeah.
There is some of the loudest people in the room are the most insecure people. But I think it's more about that. It's more about wanting to be the center of attention. And that often gets you, you know, farther in many ways. But I don't think creativity is rooted in insecurities.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, and a lot of people she might be talking about are people who are constantly performing on stage in some form for money or whatever it might be. But I mean, in your case, I mean, the creativity is the tops because you've been involved with very successful things. Screeching Weasel is one of the most successful punk bands in the history of punk music in America. Mm. And then there's also the Neo-Futurist, which Too Much Light Makes Baby Go Blind will go down in history as one of the best late night theater shows in this city's history.
True.
But there's also in between. There's also shows, and I've been there, and you've been there, where we're in the back, and there's three people, and it's not a successful run, but you're still on stage.
Yeah. I remember playing at the Electric Banana in Pittsburgh in front of three people, and we committed so hard.
You got to, man.
You have to.
So, all right. So, John, tell me about the anniversaries here. Let's talk about the Den Theater stuff. I mean, this is the show that you put on that kind of led you to being part of the Neo-Futurists.
Yeah, my group, Hope and Non-Things, which is a lot of great theater actors here, Steve Walker, Mark Montgomery, and David Cromer, did a show at Straw Dog called Living in the Present Tense. And actually, Stephanie Shaw from the Neo-Futurists came to see that, knew me from Columbia, then called me up to audition. So I got in because of that. So the show didn't do really well, but because theater then didn't do very well.
Yeah, what
but Justin Hayford, it was one of his favorite plays for a long time, so we became friends after that. And now this year is coming up. So basically, I auditioned and then put that show up around the same time. So right now, actually, New Year's Eve will be my 20th anniversary of being in Too Much Light, because I started on New Year's Eve.
Wow.
And then the show will open up in November, Living in the Present Tense.
So when you come back, that's what you got on.
Yes, I go right into rehearsals for Living in the Present Tense.
See, you've already booked. That's amazing.
Yeah.
We're talking about it. You're going to Japan for seven months starting next week, and you've already got what you're doing when you land 7 months from now.
Oh, immediately when I land. We're actually having a reading next week. But
at the airport? You're doing it at the airport?
Yeah, at the airport.
Doing it at the Potbellies at Midway. You guys are doing a reading for a play before you go to Japan.
Yeah. But I wasn't in it last time, so I'm excited. I'm going to be in it this time. So.
Well, John, congrats on all the success. I mean, and good luck going back to Japan. What I mean, outside of doing that show, what are you looking forward to most about getting back and living in Japan for 7 months?
I love the food there. I've learned to love sushi very much. And the people there are really great. And I'm looking forward to, if I ever lose my wallet, I will get it back.
That's a Japanese thing.
Yes.
All right. That's good to know.
Yeah, it is good to know.
John Jughead Pearson, the man behind Screeching Weasel, the punk band here in Chicago, who just, you know, like I said, is one of the most influential bands in punk rock history.
You could say pop, because we influenced the whole pop.
I keep saying pop. I don't know what pop keeps
popping
in my
head. Punk is, pop punk is what it became afterwards.
Right, so. Right. Yeah. And now, you know, 20th year anniversary for Neo Futurist, 20th anniversary for the Den Theater Show.
Yes.
Congrats on all your success. I'll see you in 7 months, man.
Thank you, Justin.
John Jughead Pearson. Love that guy. You know, he's an inspiration to so many different artists who are performing on stage now. I mean, we talked about this sort of pop punk, you know, he's an inspiration. Screeching Weasel is, you know, Blink 182 and Alkaline Trio and all those kind of bands. Green Day, huge. Huge influence on them. But beyond that, like, I think of all the different theatrical performers in town who, when they were in college or when they came to Chicago, they went and saw Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind. We all have that story of, like, oh, I got to sit on the floor to watch the Neo Futurists. And it was John Pearson, man, jumping up, number 32, hey, knock, knock, who's there? You know? But it's amazing to think about how much he's influenced a lot of different people. So it's always fun to be able to have artists like John come in and talk about what he thinks of the art form, about performing. You know, so we didn't really plan that, but I saw that article about Sia, and I thought about, you know, the performers I know. I mean, John's been on stage 30 years straight. I mean, I asked him in the break. He's like, there's not like, I mean, it's only like days where he's not on stage, like, you know, like maybe from a Monday to a Thursday. But it's not like he takes 2 months off or 3 months off. Like, he's always performing. That's amazing. All right, coming up, Kevin Pang's going to be here, talk about the digital release of his movie For Grace. Also coming up 10 o'clock, Character Flaws. We'll play some classic stuff tonight from Bob and Ray, tribute to the passing of Bob Elliott. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, joining me now in studio, a familiar voice around these parts, former Tribune food writer Kevin Pang. Kevin recently left the Tribune. He's working on other projects, including his documentary film that he worked on with Mark Helanowski called For Grace, which just this week is now available for download. The film features renowned chef Curtis Duffy and his story about growing up mired in tragedy to becoming one of the most successful chefs in the world. The movie title For Grace refers to his West Loop restaurant, Grace. It showed at all sorts of film festivals back in 2015, including South by Southwest. And now you can get it on iTunes, Amazon, and Google Play. Kevin Pang, good to see you, buddy.
Justin, I've not been back at Tribune Tower in 2 months, and I'm so glad the first face I see is yours. So thanks for having
me,
Justin.
You know, the security didn't want to let you back in. I had to do some work. So talk about, I mean, this is big news for you guys, because before this film, which got so much critical acclaim, was just available for screeners, essentially, to go see it at film festivals.
Yeah, so essentially this was a movie. It's so weird to call it a movie, because we never had any intentions of it being any sort of film, any feature-length film, but we made this with two cameras that we bought from Best Buy, and it was supposed to be a 15-minute short film for the Chicago Tribune website, right? And just as we kept shooting and shooting, we realized, okay, there's a deeper story here. And eventually it became this 92-minute feature-length film. And
wow.
We submitted this to a bunch of festivals, and we figured this was a lottery ticket, because if we don't get in, we're out $25, and that's totally fine. And we got rejected to, like, the Central Illinois Independent Podunk Film Festival, whatever it was, right? We got rejected. Yeah, I know. So we rejected that. We're like, okay, we'll never get in. And then we got a note actually about a year ago around this time from South by Southwest, and they said, you're in. And I'm like, this has got to be a joke. Out of 7,700 films, we were one of, like, 20 documentaries to make it into the festival. We were completely blown away. And so after that, we just got into a number of, like, really great festivals, including the Chicago International Film Festival, the one in Seattle and in Nashville and Melbourne, Australia. Just traveled the world, and completely astonishing, completely we just never expected.
Let me ask you this, as a reporter, as someone who's worked in journalism, how often have you in your career had a moment where you've been working on a story and you say, you know what, there's more – than what I have. I mean, is that a normal thing for you, or was this just, you know, slapped you in the face?
It's definitely rare, but I think the best stories happen that way because you go into it really with a blank slate and you have no expectations of what the story is. We went into the story, we wanted to document this one chef, Curtis Duffy, who wanted to build what he calls the best restaurant in America. And we thought, okay, it's an interesting narrative in that a lot of chefs, when this first happened, this was like 2010, 2011, they were doing a lot of like comfort food. They were doing a lot more accessible food. Meanwhile, this guy, Curtis, who worked at Alinea and Avenues, is going the other direction.
He's very high-end.
Very high-end, where dinner for two costs like $700, right? Yeah. So we thought, okay, if this was an interesting plot point of someone doing really expensive food and wanting to open – having this great, grand ambition for the best restaurant.
And it was
in the
really about getting the space and putting up the, you know, this is what he's going to do. He's going to build this kitchen. It's going to be great. But there's much more to Curtis's story.
Exactly, right. So we were filming. We thought this was going to open in 8 months, right? And so by month six, we realized, okay, this is not going to open in 8 months. In the end, it took about 18 months to open. And so in the interim, we were filming so many like carpets and blueprints and chairs. I mean, it was just like the most procedural stuff. And we ran out of things to ask him. So one day we were at Curtis's apartment and we just asked him, tell me about your family. And something happened that day. This was 8 months into the filming. We find out about what happened to his parents. I mean, he has a pretty tragic backstory. We find out about what happens, his relationship with his home economics teacher, who Curtis has the surrogate mother relationship with. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I remember Mark, my co-director, and myself, we drove home that night. This was after a 17-hour filming day, and we said nothing to each other. We were in total shock. Like, we could not believe what just happened. He just dropped this bombshell of a revelation.
And it's a well-documented story about, you know, tragedy, and I don't want to give it away for the movie. But it's interesting because he didn't lead with it. He didn't talk about it. He didn't say, okay, let me tell you about my childhood.
Right.
I mean, it took you a while to get this out of him. I mean, it had to have been a total shock.
Yeah, it was a total shock. And it goes back to the point you were making earlier, Justin, about how the best stories really are ones that you didn't expect. And so we went into it thinking this was a story about a chef in the restaurant industry. But it was really about a person and what happens if you want to be the best, the sacrifices you have to make in order to get there. And for him, the sacrifice was losing his marriage and, you know, not living with his two young daughters. And so and not having a lot of relationships
and
outside.
You've covered food for a long time in this town, and you know that to be a consistent storyline. When we have chefs in here on the show, their commitment, there's something they have to sacrifice.
Look at all the chefs who have marital problems. The divorce rate is just insane. Like, you wouldn't believe how high it is. Look at all the vices that manifest in drugs and alcohol. So, I mean, it's a really tough business because the hours are long, the pay isn't good, and you're not working. You're working when everyone else is off. You're working nights, weekends, holidays. So it's very easy to fall into the trap. So I think really what we're trying to achieve with the movie is it's about trying to achieve balance but never quite achieving it, and it being just a series of course corrections. Like, once you go one way, you tip back the other way, and then you tip back the other way.
We're talking with Kevin Pang, a former Chicago Tribune food reporter and also the man behind, along with Mark Helanowski, the documentary For Grace, which follows Curtis Duffy in the opening of Grace Restaurant. Let's get to the point of making a film. I mean, for you, Kevin, you know, I know you as a guy who's we've known each other for a long time, talking about food and other things. And you had done a lot of multimedia projects with the Tribune. But talk about the process of making a feature-length documentary. This is your first project, your debut documentary. Talk about that whole process.
Wow. It is a... I mean, you would think in the beginning we would just turn on the cameras and just record everything and figure, okay, we'll assemble something from that. You know, we'll assemble a 15-minute clip. Because, again, originally the intentions were to be a really short procedural. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't even call it a film. It's just like a short video for online, right? When we realized that it was going to become a film, we have to think about, okay, 90 minutes, which is about the length of a feature documentary, is a long time, and you're basically telling people who are watching this, okay, in return for you sitting through 90 minutes of your life, we will try to entertain you, we will try to keep you wrapped, we will try to intrigue you. And so you have to fulfill on that promise. And there's a lot of things we have to consider. So we didn't want to make a movie that was for foodies, quote unquote. Like if this was a movie that was just about, look at these beautiful food shots and it's about chefs as personalities, I don't think it would have resonated. It had to have these greater themes that I think people like my mother could mm-hmm. resonate. You know, she's not reading food right. blogs and she's not eating $700 meals.
But
right?
I mean, is it the same concept for you as a reporter, as a writer who, you know, creating story arcs? I mean, there has to be an arc. There has to be plot. There has to be subplots
Absolutely.
For a documentary.
It's more like, I think, writing a very long magazine story and writing perhaps a novel in that you have to think about it in scenes. Each scene has to build to something. You know, within each 2-minute, 3-minute scene, there has to be some sort of a payoff. And so you're also thinking about things like the use of silence, the use of music. You know, do you want to use dialogue? I mean, there's one scene where the, you know, Curtis Duffy and his home ec teacher, they're having this conversation on the first night that the restaurant is there, and she's one of their first customers, right? And rather than just having the dialogue of them hearing what he says to her and she says to him, we just kept it silent and we had just a really soft music in the background because we felt like the visuals could tell the story much better than him saying it out literally. So it's a lot of considerations mm-hmm. like that, thinking about things in scenes, thinking about, you know, tension and how much to cut. You know, it's a lot of things that we never thought about.
People go to film school and they you know, they do all this thing, yeah. all these things to be able to get to the point of having a debut documentary. I mean, it was a happy accident in the way that it was more than, you know, doing online yeah. video for the trip. But let me ask you, because, you know, there's much more than just the filmmaking aspect. I mean, obviously, we talked a little bit about getting it into film festivals. But here you are again. I mean, you're moving into like having it available for download. I mean, this passion project, it doesn't end.
It doesn't end. I think we were looking at our iTunes debut this morning. I think we were something like number 7 on the documentaries list, which
awesome.
Is completely
yeah,
mind-blowing
right.
because, you know, again, we had so little expectations of it from the beginning. But, yeah, it's something that we've learned just from doing. And I took a lot of lessons from my 11 years here at the Chicago Tribune, much of it as a feature writer, and really applying the tenets of storytelling and journalism and reporting towards that. And I think what it ultimately comes down to, I think, and this is sort of a lesson for any filmmaker or journalist, it all comes down to the story.
Yep.
It's not about how glitzy it is. It's not about like how, you know, how expensive your lenses are, your camera bodies are. You have to find a good story. And we were so incredibly lucky to stumble on this great story.
Let me ask you as we wrap up here, I mean, is this the start of a new career for you? I mean, are you gonna look for new projects? I mean, are you going to be Kevin Pang, the filmmaker?
Oh, boy. I have no idea. So I've left the Tribune about a couple of months ago and trying to still figure out what to do. I think I want to see what happens with this movie because, you know, we just landed on iTunes this week. Mm-hmm. And so who knows what's going to happen? I think I kind of want to see how people react to it. And, you know, I think the best course of action is just to let things come to you and just be open and say, you know, I think it's a tenet of improv, you know, yes and say yes to everything, you know. So that's something I'm going to try to say yes to and just not be closed to any opportunities because it might be in filmmaking, might be in journalism. I'm sort of doing a lot of freelance magazine writing right now. But who knows? We'll see where this movie takes us.
Well, we'll call you filmmaker and journalist. We'll go filmmaker first.
I prefer auteur.
Auteur. Kevin Pang. The debut documentary For Grace, which just played to festivals throughout 2015, the critical acclaim, is now available for download at iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, all the places. Kevin, great to see you and continued success.
Thanks, Justin.
It's a download coming up. Character flaws. That's right. We're going to delve into the world of sketch comedy, improvisation, characters. We're going to talk to an undecided voter. We're also going to talk to a longtime strategist about how you win an election. And also we'll have our tribute to Bob and Ray. Bob Elliott died today at the age of 92. We'll play some archival stuff from them. Great. It's so good. It's so simple. And I don't mean that any sort of, you know, like I think they're hilarious. But the premise is usually straight up. It's radio stuff. and they get to it. It's sublime in its simplicity. Like, it's very, very. I was watching and listening to a bunch of Bob and Ray stuff today. I really liked it. So, talk with them. But first, before we do that, tomorrow night we're only on for another half an hour. 7:30. It's Blackhawks will be in Arizona to take on the Arizona Coyotes. I guess that Phoenix Coyotes was too provincial. They need to make it the whole state.
Yeah.
I just looked that up because you said they're playing the Arizona Coyotes. I'm like, I know them as the Phoenix Coyotes because they beat the Blackhawks in 2012 as the Phoenix Coyotes in round one. That was a big upset.
Hmm. I forgot who it was.
And,
hockey fan.
Yeah, I know. And I forgot who it was, but someone can tell me 312-981-7200. Which Blackhawk in overtime in that game that they lost that sent them home centered the puck to the Coyotes? I want to say it was Sampillo, or I can't remember which guy it was. It was one of the guys who was newer to the Blackhawks they just brought in,
mm-hmm.
and he had made a mistake where he centered it back,
oh.
and that was it. And the guy picked it up, and it was over, just like that. And that's one of the things I hate about hockey. Like, you're so excited, and like, oh, it's over? That's it? Playoff hockey, overtime hockey. All right. Anyway, let's get a preview. Let's do a preview. Judd's got the preview of the game that you can hear here on WGN Radio tomorrow night, the Coyotes and the Hawks.
Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer.
He is my enemy.
This is Know Your Enemy on 720 WGN. Here's Judd Surratt.
The Arizona Coyotes are the biggest surprise team in the West. They may not ultimately make the postseason, but the team with the lowest payroll in the league, a franchise that finished dead last in 2014-15, a roster that features five rookies, and a group that's missing injured goalie and former Vezina finalist Mike Smith long-term, wasn't supposed to sniff a playoff spot. However, with just over 2 months left in the season, that's exactly where they are. When Mike Smith went down with a core muscle injury in December, head coach Dave Tippett was left with well-traveled Anders Lindback and rookie Louis Domingue, who's earned the bulk of the starts in net.
You know, the when you're in thing is, we'll just monitor that as we go along here. If one of them starts playing really well, then we'll go that way. But right now it feels both of them have a chance to prove themselves.
Tippett's team has made a dramatic improvement offensively. The Coyotes ranked 29th in goals for last season. This year, sparked by rookies Max Domi and Anthony Duclair, Arizona's offense has vaulted into the top 10. The 20-year-old Domi is a tenacious competitor with high-end skill, but like his dad, Ty, who terrorized the league in the 90s, he's small.
Well, he's 5'9", or thereabouts, but he plays at all between 190 and 200 pounds, and he's extremely strong and really dedicated to the game in terms of being as physically fit. He's a diabetic. He's always had to watch exactly what he eats. I mean, he's been eating to win for a long, long time. But in terms of the style of game that he has, puck protection, low to the ice, excellent first, second, quick step, ability to make plays, ability to score goals.
Duclair is similar in stature to Domi, formerly the Rangers' top prospect, which Arizona pried loose at the 2015 NHL trade deadline. Duclair is an explosive player who's willing to battle for pucks. Domi and Duclair have had plenty of help. Michael Botker, the 8th overall pick in 2008, is having a career year offensively. Second-year pro Tobias Reeder is on pace for 20 goals. Former Blackhawk Antoine Vermette re-signed with the Coyotes to be a steady two-way force. And 39-year-old Shane Doan might have saved his best for his last season in the National Hockey League.
Bodker crisscrossing with Stone. Sends right circle to Reeder. Reeder to Bodker. Left circle. One-timer. Doan. He scores! The captain has done it. As the hats come cascading down on the ice, Shane Doan with his second career hat trick. And in the process, he's tied Dale Hawerchuk for the most goals in franchise history at 379.
Arizona's best offensive player, though, might be on the blue line. Oliver Ekman-Larsson, deadly on the power play, is on pace for his second straight 20-goal season. 22-year-old Connor Murphy plays a rugged style with size to back it up, but beyond veteran shot blocker Zabinek-McCulloch, it's a thin, inexperienced group. Head coach Dave Tippett, the NHL's Coach of the Year in 2011, knows exactly how to adjust and squeezes out every bit of ability and energy from a shorthanded group. A masterful defensive tactician, if Tippett's team can cut down its goals against and get a little help from cash-strapped general manager Don Maloney at the deadline, the Coyotes just might have a shot at sneaking into the playoffs in a down Pacific division. For Know Your Enemy, I'm Judd Surratt.
Keep your enemies close.
I will say this. Great. It's Judd's so good. Every time I feel like I know hockey, then I listen to that. He's dropping names, not just of the players, but the front office. If Don Melroney will give him some time, I'm like, come on, man. Why are you making me feel so bad? I'm trying. Right? I feel like, you know, I am in the presence of legends, and you know, I gotta learn the Arizona Coyote general manager. I just got to.
It's just a character flaw. I got a character flaw. You never please a mom. It's just a character flaw.
All right. It's character flaws. It's Wednesday night. We thought that, you know, we'd like to honor some of the great performers, writers, and comedians that are here in this town. So every Wednesday night at 10 o'clock, we bring you a new segment called Character Flaws. It's amazing how much talent is available in Chicago and available to this show. In this, we will bring you sketch comedy characters and, of course, improv. It's going to be a fun ride. So sit back and enjoy. I'll host it, of course, participate a little bit. We got some good stuff tonight. We're going to talk politics. We got to talk politics, right? I mean, this is going to be a big part of Character Flaws. Just the idea that there are so many different political storylines. Tonight, we're going to hear from someone who tells us who's worked a number of years in Chicago and talk about what it takes to run an effective campaign. He's a great kid, and I hope that he gives us some insight to what it takes for some of the presidential candidates who are gearing up here in Illinois because they had success in Iowa. We'll talk at that. Also, a tribute to Bob and Ray. Play some of the classic stuff the stuff we're going to play tonight. I think the one clip was 1951. Some great stuff. Of course, Bob Elliott died today at the age of 92, so we'll pick that up after the hour. But, you know, I wanted to start because all eyes are on New Hampshire now, and this is a big part because, you know, with Donald Trump losing and Ted Cruz winning there and Marco Rubio coming in third, there are a lot of votes that can go different directions. You know, people who were lined up with one candidate have moved, shifted. Well, who wins in New Hampshire may lose in South Carolina. So what I want to do is get kind of a temperature for who's voting for who, especially when it comes to the undecided voter. In New Hampshire. So joining us on the line now is an undecided voter, the Downloads undecided voter, Randy. Hey, Randy.
Oh, hey there, Justin. How you doing?
I'm doing good. So you're an undecided voter in New Hampshire, and I guess my first question to you is, why undecided? Why are you an undecided voter?
Well, I mean, I'm undecided. I can't figure nothing out. I mean, you know, I just have no idea which millionaire Washington, D.C. lawyer or governor or senator or corporate lobbyist has the most in common with me.
Right.
You know, I'm sorry I'm not all fancy pants and I don't shop at IKEA spending $1 million on stools. You know, I'm sorry I don't own a watch.
Right. No, I understand. I'm not making any judgment on whether or not you own a watch. You know, we've talked, Randy, and I know you started, you know, early on in the campaign saying you were a Trump guy. You were going to vote for Trump. Why aren't you staying with Trump?
Well, you know, I'm the owner of a double wide, and I'm considered a bit of a character on trivia night at the Buck and Donkey. So I thought, you know, a real estate magnate and reality TV star was kind of my type of folk. But then my friends Travis and Travis Jr. and Lil Travis started getting all the attention on Trivia Nights by saying these hilarious Trump lines. And there's one thing I can't stand, it's people not paying attention to me, which is why I'm undecided. Everybody loves an undecided guy. Pay attention to me. Hey, pay attention to me. I don't know what I'm doing. Pay attention to me.
Well, I mean, Randy, you also have the ability to move to the other side of the aisle. I mean, you could. What about Hillary Clinton?
Oh, I got choices. That's what America's all about. You know, wait, now, I got to tell you, Hillary, you know, as a man who has gotten in touch with the wife a few times, I do like a lady who'll let a few mistakes slide, you know, when her husband goes out with his buddies, has one too many drinks, and ends up ruining the election cycle for his vice president, you know. But I started hearing all this about Benghazi, and I was like, well, hello, Your Majesty. Sorry, I'm not all frou-frou in New York City, you know. I want a president who eats like I do, you know, Pabst Blue Ribbon, some Vienna sausages, not some fancy arugula and endive and Benghazi on their salad. For all I know, they grow that stuff in Saudi Arabia. So no thanks, Your Majesty.
Okay, so if it's not Hillary and it's not Trump, you're running out of choices. Who are you going to go for?
Well, you know, at first I was pretty excited that Tom Cruise was running for president. I'd like a president to go all Jack Reacher on ISIS.
Right.
But then someone told me he's not Tom's brother. He's Penelope's brother. And I don't know nothing about her or her politics. I did see he was holding a gun on the news the other day to appeal to working folk, but I don't take kindly to that. Hey, you know what? Maybe some of us can't afford a gun. If we have to murder something to death, I don't have that choice. Maybe if he does a press conference where he strangles something or beats something to death with a hammer, right. Then maybe I'll think again.
All right. I don't know. I mean, okay, so it's not Cruz. I mean, are you leaning for Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, Bernie Sanders. That's where I'm going right there. Bernie
Wow.
Sanders. I think that's my man. Yeah.
All right. Well, why Bernie Sanders?
He is super white. He is like the whitest person I've ever seen. He's incredibly white.
All right.
I like that. I got a lot in common with that.
Downloads undecided voter Randy, who lives in New Hampshire, deciding who he's going to vote for president. Sounds like it's Bernie Sanders for all the right reasons. Thanks, Randy.
God bless you. God bless America. God bless the United States. And God bless Dale Earnhardt Jr.
There you go. There it is. Randy. All right. There you go. Randy, of course. It goes by his other name, Adam Witt, who joins us every week here on Character Flaws. More to come. All right, welcome back to The Download. It's Character Flaws, where we bring you the best sketch, improv, characters, and performance from Chicago's regulars, including our next guest, who will teach us how to run an effective campaign. It is a big time for politics here in the city of Chicago. The primary is coming up here in March. So many different candidates, whether it be for the state's attorney's office or for running for state legislature, whatever it is, right now is crunch time. You know, and they may be second guessing and trying to figure out what's the best and most efficient way to run a campaign. And that's why we introduce a new segment here on The Download. The Download's campaign operative, Jason Challenger, is with us. He's run campaigns in the past, and he wants to give you his ideas for what makes a great campaign. Of course, Jason Challenger was the intern for the Alderman Ed Buss campaign. He was interned from 2004 to 2015.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long. Well, Jason, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Justin. Great to see you.
So
great show.
Thank you.
Congratulations on all of this.
Yeah, well, it's been
amazing.
A year. Yeah. So
thanks for the regular segment. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, we'll see if it's regular. But you sort of set it up that running a campaign has its challenges.
That's exactly right. And how do you manage those challenges, right? So I've picked five core challenges. Look at my hand right now. How many fingers am I holding up?
Five.
Right? So there's one challenge per hand.
Well.
And I'm going to give you a hand with these clues right now. So these are the five challenges facing any campaign.
Okay.
Would it be helpful if I go through them for your constituents?
That's the idea. Yeah.
Fantastic.
That would be the right now would be the time to do that.
And after this, is there going to be a politician who might be hiring?
I don't. I'm sure they listen to WGN, and I couldn't tell you, but
so yeah. This might be a job interview as well, potentially. That's exciting.
Very.
So the five challenges. The first. Well, it's more of a story, really. The other day, I was talking to an old lady named my grandma, and I said, "Grandma, what do I need to focus on?" And she said, "Two things: people and healthcare."
So that's your first challenge.
That's the first challenge. Okay. Is are you focusing on people, and are you focusing on healthcare? Because people come and go. You know what doesn't come and go?
What?
Taking care of them. Okay. So are you focusing on other people? Are you helping them through whatever challenge they're going through? Number two, get the word out.
Okay.
I would suggest getting the word out through flyers.
Okay. Flyers.
What is a flyer? A flyer is an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, preferably goldenrod, that's printed in increments of 500 at a Kinko's.
Okay.
Or a UPS.
Okay.
Or a hotel lobby.
Okay.
I would suggest the Hotel Lincoln lobby. 8 cents a page. You take those flyers and you partner with a company like Starbucks to use their logo. So you put the flyer up and it says, if you vote for this alderman because of our partnership with Starbucks, you will get a free cup of coffee at any participating Starbucks.
Oh, wow. That's a great idea. That's wonderful. Then people get coffee and they realize that the alderman bought them a free cup of coffee. Is that legal? I think it's legal, right?
It is legal. It requires a partnership with a participating Starbucks, which I'm working on.
Oh, so Starbucks doesn't know about this?
They don't know about it. They do know about it. You know, they say it's all in the rollout. It wasn't rolled out exactly as I was hoping. I tweeted to Starbucks and asked them if they would be able to partner with me for a flyer campaign. I didn't get a response. So I ended up, it's only 140 characters per tweet. You know, so I ended up like breaking the whole story into about 15 tweets with 140 characters, which is like whatever, 625 tweets. So long story short, they blocked me from Twitter and they gave me a cease and desist letter saying do not use our logo under any sort of banner. So long story short, I'm not using the Starbucks thing, but
just an idea. It was an idea.
Okay.
All right. I get it. Okay. Well, that's interesting. What's a third challenge?
These are to be shared and built upon, not picked apart.
Oh, right. Okay.
Communicate your story through facts. Members of the media love getting blast faxes.
I didn't know that, but with email and even texts and other areas, I would think that fax would be yesterday.
Nope. It's actually current. Do you work in an office?
We do, yeah.
Do you have a fax machine?
I mean, I think there's one fax machine in a newsroom. Yeah.
Okay, that's good to know. So if someone maybe was spending, say, a week or 2 weeks blast faxing members of the media one at a time, it's potential you didn't get it? Is that a
It's probably
potential?
A good
idea.
It's probably
including
good
the
that
follow-ups?
They probably didn't get it.
That's good to know. Number four, go door-to-door.
Okay, so you believe in the door-to-door concept of campaigning.
People want the face-to-face interaction. Mm-hmm. They're so overwhelmed by the impersonal nature of social media in today's world that they want to press flesh. They want to see people in person.
Right, okay.
They want to ask people, why should I vote for you?
Right, okay.
Why should I check the box with your name?
Okay, good. So
you go to their house.
Yeah.
And if they're not there, walk around the back. Knock on the back door. If they're not at the back door, go through a window. If you can't get through a window, go to their mailbox. Were they home? Maybe they're traveling. Open their mail. Try and find a credit card statement that will give you their personal information. Get a credit card number with their address and then send them a note, maybe a blast fax that says, if you don't vote for my candidate, I will go shopping at Target with your credit card. Or something like that. And then they usually kind of turn around and go, okay, I'll vote. Shred the thing. Okay.
Oh, that seems a little skanky, but oh, okay. I guess that's what we get from you. You're an operative.
That's right. I'm an operative. I would say more of a consultant, more of a thought leader.
Number five. What's your last challenge? What's the big one?
Be a thought leader.
Be a
thought leader.
What does that mean?
Speak at meetings and events. Speak at conferences. Share your message with a larger population. Stand up at regular meetings and talk, even if you're not supposed to. Go to board meetings with a tape recorder and capture the content of those board meetings.
That's what being a thought leader is.
Partially. Blog a lot. Write down your ideas and send them to people. And then also show up at meetings and events and conferences and network as much as possible. And come on radio shows.
Yeah, well, okay. Being a thought leader, going door to door, getting the message out, having a good story, and there was another one in there.
Healthcare, right. Take care of people in healthcare. That's the most important one because, well, everybody wants to know that they're being taken care of, right, Justin?
That's right. Jason Challenger, our resident campaign operative.
Thank you.
Talking about what it takes to put on a great campaign to run for any office. Great to see you.
I have a quick question for you. Are you hiring?
You know, we're not.
You're not. No. That's a bummer. You should be hiring right now. Oh, my gosh. It'd be so good here.
Yeah, but it's not a campaign. Oh. It's radio. It's entirely different.
It could be campaign, though. Why don't you think of running something? Like, people love this show.
Yeah, no, I just think that this is media. We're not running a campaign in any form. It seems like your expertise is in campaign. You should be asking politicians if they're hiring.
I think you would be a good candidate.
What
ward do you live in?
Flattering. I'm a second ward kind
second,
of guy.
They need an alderman who stands for values.
Kind of don't. They got a new alderman.
Who is the new alderman?
Alderman Hopkins. He's
no, it's not. Oh, is it?
Yeah, it is.
Is he hiring?
Maybe.
Okay. I challenge you today.
I challenge you. Bridge the gap between us. Ooh, I challenge you today.
Jason Challenger, also known as Sandy Marshall, works for Second City. he's also a regular here on The Download. Oh, fun. That was good. Good. Number five, be a thought leader. It's funny. I kind of feel like it was a little too close to home, the stuff about the go in the window, go get their credit card, shop at Target. I feel like that's what Ted Cruz has allegedly did in Iowa. That's what Trump is saying he did. Essentially the same idea. All right, coming up, we're going to take a break for the news. We come back, more of Character Flaws, bringing you the best sketch comedy, improv performance. And tonight, we decided, you know, instead of doing, we need to sort of pay tribute to the masters of this. Bob and Ray, Bob Elliott, of course, passed away today at the age of 92. We're going to play some old archival footage of Bob and Ray, some of the great stuff. They're slow talkers.
It's just a character flaw. I got a character flaw. You never please a mom. It's just a character flaw.
So Download here, Character Flaw. It's Wednesday night. Every night between 10 and 11 o'clock, we do Character Flaws. Bringing you the best sketch, improv, characters, and performances that this city has to offer. Tonight, you know, it's interesting because we're putting together the show. We got bits. We've taped a couple things, put things together, you know, as we sort of put the puzzle together, that is, Character Flaws. And it's interesting because today, in the middle of the day, Bob and Ray, of course, Bob Elliott died. The news was announced that he died. He passed away at the age of 92. For those of you who don't know who Bob and Ray is, Bob and Ray are sort of the classic, if not sort of forefathers of radio comedy. They were a duo, a great duo that came up in the 50s, you know, doing radio, and they had moved on to television 60s and 70s. They had Broadway, and they were a big inspiration and influence on a lot of the performers that we know today, including David Letterman, who talks very fondly of them, and others. It's amazing to think, you know, the two sort of guys in radio. I mean, think about what we're doing here. Character Flaws is an homage almost to what Bob and Ray brought to the American radio. That was not it just wasn't a thing. And so they've had so much success, and you know, Ray Goulding died a couple decades back, so it's not or I think it was in the 90s. But tonight Bob Elliott died. So you thought, you know, and to pay tribute to those who came before us, we would play some Bob and Ray tonight, right? It's not the usual thing. We don't usually play tracks, but these are some great bits, and I've been laughing all day, you know, at the computer. The good, unbelievable thing about the time we're living in is that you can just type in Bob and Ray and be able to be transported back to a different time to see performances on television, to see guest spots on talk shows, and, of course, to be able to listen to Bob and Ray. The record, the 1970 record, which was accompanied by it really is a recording of the Broadway show they had, which is a great title, Bob and Ray, the Two and Only. Right? That's good stuff. On that, there was a great bit that continues to show. I mean, it's one of those that I think everyone's pulling out at least clips of it today, you know, to show the best of Bob and Ray, because it's one of the best that they ever did. And this was one that was, this album was recorded in front of an out live audience on Broadway. And here is the bit. Slow talker.
This is a surprise time for me because I haven't had an opportunity to meet and talk with our next guest. Incidentally, this chair here sat in Mary Magoon's dining room for years and years. I don't know if that has any special meaning to you, sir. No. But would you sit there now and tell us your name, please?
Harlow P. Whitcomb.
And where are you from?
From Glens Falls.
New York.
New York.
And what do you do?
I am the president and recording
secretary.
Secretary of the STOA.
What does that stand for?
Slow Talkers of America. We believe
in speaking slowly,
in forming
your words, thoughts,
our ideas and opinions clearly before
speaking.
We speak. We are here
in New York City.
In the city of New York, attending
a convention.
Our annual
convention.
Membership
convention.
Convention. All of our members, all 200
members
and 50
members,
seven members are here
speaking
slowly
so that you'll never be misunderstood,
as opposed to the members of the
FTOA.
T-O-A.
O-A.
A. The Fast
Talkers of America.
Talkers
of America.
Of America.
America.
Our credo
is to speak slowly.
Goes something like this.
Would you lower the curtain, please?
Will
you be a nervous wreck?
Classic Bob and Ray there. It's so good, man. It's so good. Bob Elliott, of course, passed away today at the age of 92, and we honor him tonight on Character Flaws. We'll be right back. All right, it's Character Flaws here on the download. We're wrapping up before Patty takes over. Patty Vasquez coming up pretty late. Patty Vasquez. You know, we're honoring and paying tribute to Bob and Ray. Bob Elliott, father of Chris Elliott and Abby Elliott. I was trying to figure out she was a Saturday Night Live cast member at one point. She's very funny. He was a big part of radio comedy as we know it. We just heard Slow Talker. Let's hear another one. This is great. I was trying to figure out a year on this. I couldn't figure out, but it's Fred Falvey, who's a do-it-yourself handyman. And it's the sketch is called Handyman. It was a big thing they did with this character. So take a listen. I think it's sometime I've narrowed it down between 1950 and 1955.
Now it's time once again to pick up some valuable tips for you home handymen as we pay another of our regular visits to the basement workshop of Fred Falvey, the do-it-yourselfer. And Fred, I'm glad I found you at home today. When I saw all those rolled up newspapers out in your front yard, I was afraid you Might be away on vacation.
No, Ray. I rolled up all those papers and scattered them around the yard about a week ago. It's part of a do-it-yourself project I'm involved in.
Well, I can't imagine what it is, Fred, unless it has something to do with all the burglars you'll attract by creating the impression that you're away from home.
No, I admit having all those rolled up papers in the yard does attract a few prowlers who think the place is deserted, but what little they steal is more than offset by the money I save from leaving papers out there until they get good and soggy.
You just leave them out there in the rain and snow or whatever until it happens again?
Yes. You see, the idea is to let nature convert the newspapers back into wood pulp. Then you can burn them in the fireplace just like logs, only the cost is much less, of course.
Well, it certainly sounds like another wonderful example of better living by doing it yourself, Fred.
I think so.
How long does it take for the natural elements to turn newspapers back into wood pulp?
Well, I'm not really sure, Ray. I read in a book where it would take about 200,000 years for paper to become converted into coal, but I'm certain changing it into wood pulp wouldn't take near that long.
Well, then, I suppose it could even happen within our lifetime.
Oh.
It'll be a real money saver if it does,
too. If it does, right.
Now, I know that all our beloved friends of the radio audience are anxious to hear about the do-it-yourself project that you've chosen to describe today.
Well, today I've chosen a real money-saving project to describe for our beloved friends of the radio audience. I'm sure most of us are aware that handmade lampshades have gone up in price faster than the general cost of living.
Well, no, I wasn't aware of that, Frank.
Most people are aware of it, Ray. However, it's not generally known that do-it-yourselfers can make lovely lampshades right in the basement workshop just using some inexpensive equipment and a few simple tools.
Well, I noticed that you have some blue paper stacked up here on the workbench. Is that what you're using for your lampshade project?
Yes.
What?
This paper's good, sturdy 20-pound bond, Ray. Comes cut into 8.5 by 11 sheets as a rule, and the colors, these particular sheets, is blue.
So what do you do after you've selected the color for your lampshade? Do you make some kind of a wire frame to, you know, stretch the paper across?
No, you don't have to get into all that. You just roll a sheet of paper into a sort of a paper cone, taking care to leave the small end large enough to fit around a bulb socket. And then you staple the edges of your paper together using an ordinary office stapler filled with number 5 wire staples. Here, I'll show you how it's done. Like that, and that.
Well, Fred is stapling along the edge of... He's stapling along the edge of his rolled-up sheet of paper. That certainly is making it stay in the conical shape you want. I don't quite know what you're going to do with it, though. What are you going to do with it now?
Well, the rest is actually easy, Ray. I just unscrew this bulb hanging down from the ceiling. Now I put my blue paper shade around the socket like this. And then as I screw the bulb back in, that holds my cone-shaped piece of paper where I want it. That's why I rolled the paper into a cone to make the shade in the first place, so the bulb would hold it in place.
I see. Well, of course, this piece of blue paper you've stapled together makes a fine shade for a naked bulb hanging down from the ceiling, but there aren't many fixtures like that around anymore. What if you want a shade for a regular lamp?
Well, you can buy those at any lampshade store, right? It's the ones for those old-time ceiling fixtures that are hard to locate. I went to 6 or 7 stores and couldn't find one.
Well, then you can save time as well as money by making your own, if you happen to be one of those rare individuals with an old-time ceiling fixture. So we could certainly say that this is just one more prime example of how to live better by doing it yourself. And we've been privileged to hear all about it directly from the basement workshop of Fred Falvey, the do-it-yourselfer.
Fred Falvey, do-it-yourselfer. See, and it's amazing if you go through all the characters and people out there who are fans of Bob and Ray know what I'm talking about. That's their style. What you just heard there is the two of them going back and forth in these sort of fake interviews. Even the slow talker is the same concept, but the two of them going back and forth that way. And they continued it into television, worked in variety shows, were a big part, like I said, of the late night talk show scene. They were always guesting on those and worked and really had a lot of work and a solid career even into the 80s and 90s until Ray died, I believe, is in 1992, 92 or something like that.
1990, maybe?
Yeah, somewhere around there. And then Bob Elliott had been doing a lot of... he had done some television work. He'd worked with his son.
Yes, on the...
On Get a Life.
Get a Life, which is...
Your favorite show.
Well, I love that show. It's if you haven't seen it, you know, just...
Does it hold up?
Oh, my God, yes. Yeah. I mean, I've watched it within the past couple of years. It's just so good. And like, Bob, you know, plays Chris's dad in the show.
Right.
Chris is like, you know, a grown man living in his parents' hot basement. And his dad's just always in his robe. No matter what, every scene, he's in his robe. Yeah, so good. If you haven't seen it, try to find it. I'm sure it's on Netflix or something. Yeah. Or DVD.
Sad day.
Or...
You probably find it on probably Netflix, right? This is another one I'm going to go home and I'm going to search on Comcast, and they'll be like, nope. And by the way, this Comcast ain't going to work for 6 hours. That's what's good.
How's that coming, by the way? You're trying to find some shows to watch.
Yeah, no, I was trying to find a bunch, and none of them were there. No, I found one. It taped a random river. I got to tell you, my River Monsters, we don't have a lot of time, but, I've been big on River Monsters. Like, that's my big thing. I think that's the best show that was ever done. And I just figured out that you can search it and then record every time River Monsters is on. It just records it. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I did that. And I'm like, River Monsters, record. So like on a Friday night or whatever. And I'm like, okay. Or with our crazy schedule, like I'll go home and I'll be like, there. I watched. So then I look, none. None are coming in. I'm like, what happened? It's like River Monsters is done. They said, we have rerun it to death. It was probably a 2010 show. We are moving on from River Monsters.
Ah, they took it off.
And then one popped up, and it was like a little goofier one that was like the Rivers of Africa, a little different. But this is what he did, man. He goes to a river in Botswana, right?
Mm-hmm.
To stalk the tiger fish. Could they be the ones that are killing? Do they have a taste for blood? There's only one way to find out, to go underneath. This dude goes, he gets a snorkel on. And he, like a whole thing, and he goes down in the river, and they're like, well, you really can't do that because the crocodiles, they hunt men. They'll eat man. And so he goes down there because the water temperature is cold, so they're sluggish. And he, like, and they got the cameras on and everything, and it's, like, bright, and you get to see, like, the underbelly of a Botswana river.
Mm-hmm.
Scared the living daylights out of me. And there were the tiger fish, and he was chumming the water to try and get them to bite him. To see if they could be the ones that could cause all this trouble. And they didn't. They took off. And he's like, maybe they're not the ones that caused this big... There was like he's investigating a murder or something like that. Or a fish murder. It's all fish murders. And I don't even know if it's real. And then they reenact them. It's the best thing. Where they just put an actor in a little area. And like he splashes all over like he's being attacked by a fish. So it's really, it's fish murder. That's what they should bring it back. I'm going out to Hollywood. So Patty may be able to help us. And we can see if we could pitch Fish Murder, which is a follow-up to River Monsters. Anyway, yeah, so River Monsters, I did watch that one. I think it was last night. So.